Chapter 2. At least one Saturday a month now he takes half a day off from work and goes to the Upper East Side. When he leaves Green Street, the neighborhood's boutiques and stores haven't yet opened for the day. When he returns, they are closed for the night. On these days he can imagine the Soho Harold knew as a child, a place shuttered and unpeopled, a place without life. His first stop is the building on Park and 78th, where he takes the elevator to the 6th floor. The maid lets him into the apartment, and he follows her to the back study, which is sunny and large, and where Lucian is waiting. Not waiting for him, necessarily, but waiting. There is always a late breakfast laid out for him. Thin wedges of smoked salmon and tiny buckwheat pancakes one time, a cake glazed white with lemon icing the next. He can never bring himself to eat anything, although sometimes when he is feeling especially helpless, he accepts a slice of cake from the maid and holds the plate in his lap for the entire visit. But although he doesn't eat anything, he does drink cup after cup of tea, which is always steeped exactly how he likes it. Lucian eats nothing either. He has been fed earlier. Nor does he drink. Now he goes to Lucian and takes his hand. "Hi, Lucian," he tells him. He had been in London when Lucian's wife, Meredith, called him. It was the week of Bergeson's retrospective at MoMA, and he had arranged to be out of the city on business. Lucian had had a massive stroke, Meredith said. He would live, but the doctors didn't yet know how great the damage would be. Lucian was in the hospital for 2 weeks, and when he was released, it was clear that his impairment was severe. And although it is not yet 5 months later, it has remained so. The features on the left side of his face seem to be melting off of him, and he cannot use his left arm or leg either. He can still speak, remarkably well, but his memory has vanished, the past 20 years deserting him completely. In early July, he fell and hit his head and was in a coma. Now he is too unsteady to even walk, and Meredith has moved them back from their house in Connecticut to their apartment in the city, where they can be closer to the hospital and their daughters. He thinks Lucian likes, or at least doesn't mind, his visits, but he doesn't know this for sure. Certainly Lucian doesn't know who he is. He is someone who appears in his life and then disappears, and every time he must reintroduce himself. "Who are you?" Lucian asks. "Jude," he says. "Now remind me," Lucian says, pleasantly, as if they're meeting at a cocktail party. "How do I know you?" "You were my mentor," he tells him. "Ah," says Lucian, and then there is a silence. In the first weeks, he tried to make Lucian remember his own life. He talked about Rose and Pritchard, and about people they knew, and cases they used to argue about. But then he realized that the expression he had mistaken, in his own stupid hopefulness, for thoughtfulness, was in reality fear. And so now he discusses nothing from the past, or nothing from their past together, at least. He lets Lucian direct the conversation, and although he doesn't understand the references Lucian makes, he smiles and tries to pretend he does. "Who are you?" Lucian asks. "Jude," he says. "Now tell me, how do I know you?" "You were my mentor." "Oh, at Groton?" "Yes," he says, trying to smile back. "At Groton." Sometimes, though, Lucian looks at him. "Mentor," he says. "I'm too young to be your mentor." Or sometimes he doesn't ask at all, simply begins a conversation in its middle, and he has to wait until he has enough clues and can determine what role he has been assigned, one of his daughter's long ago boyfriends, or a college classmate, or a friend at the country club, before he can respond appropriately. In these hours, he learns more about Lucian's earlier life than Lucian had ever revealed to him before. Although Lucian is no longer Lucian, at least not the Lucian he knew. This Lucian is vague and featureless. He is as smooth and cornerless as an egg. Even his voice, that droll, croaking roll with which Lucian used to deliver his sentences, each one a statement, the pause he used to leave between them because he had grown so used to people's laughter, the particular way he had of structuring his paragraphs, beginning and ending each with a joke that wasn't really a joke, but an insult cloaked in a silken cape, is different. Even when they were working together, he knew that the Lucian of the office was not the Lucian of the country club, but he never saw that other Lucian. And now, finally, he has. He does. It is the only person he sees. This Lucian talks about the weather and golf and sailing and taxes, but the tax laws he discusses are from 20 years ago. He never asks him anything about himself, who he is, what he does, why he is sometimes in a wheelchair. Lucian talks, and he smiles and nods back at him, wrapping his hands around his cooling cup of tea. When Lucian's hands tremble, he takes them in his own, which he knows helps him when his hands shake. Willem used to do this, and breathe with him, and it would always calm him. When Lucian drools, he takes the edge of his napkin and blots the saliva away. Unlike him, however, Lucian doesn't seem embarrassed by his own shaking and drooling, and he is relieved that he doesn't. He's not embarrassed for Lucian either, but he is embarrassed by his inability to do more for him. "He loves seeing you, Jude," Meredith always says, but he doesn't think this is true, really. He sometimes thinks he continues to come more for Meredith's sake than for Lucian's, and he realizes that this is the way it is, the way it must be. You don't visit the lost. You visit the people who search for the lost. Lucian is not conscious of this, but he can remember being so when he was sick, both the first time and the second, and Willem was taking care of him. How grateful he was when he would wake and find someone other than Willem sitting next to him. "Roman's with him," Richard or Malcolm would say, or, "He and JB went out for lunch," and he'd relax. In the weeks after his amputations, when all he wanted to do was give up, those moments in which he could imagine that Willem might be being comforted were his only moments of happiness. And so he sits with Meredith after sitting with Lucian, and they talk, although she too asks him nothing about his life, and this is fine with him. She is lonely. He is lonely too. She and Lucian have 2 daughters, one of whom lives in New York, but is forever going in and out of rehab. The other lives in Philadelphia with her husband and 3 children, and is a lawyer herself. He has met both of these daughters, who are a decade or so younger than he is, although Lucian is Harold's age. When he went to visit Lucian in the hospital, the older of them, the one who lives in New York, had looked at him with such hatred that he had almost stepped back, and then had said to her sister, "Oh, and look who it is. Daddy's pet. What a surprise." "Grow up, Portia," the younger one had hissed. To him, she said, "Jude, thanks for coming. I'm so sorry about Willem." "Thank you for coming, Jude," Meredith says now, kissing him goodbye. "I'll see you soon." She always asks this, as if he might someday tell her she won't. "Yes," he says. "I'll email you." "Do," she says, and waves as he walks down the hall toward the elevator. He always has the sense that no one else visits, and yet how can that be? "Don't let that be," he pleads. Meredith and Lucian have always had lots of friends. They threw dinner parties. It wasn't unusual to see Lucian leaving the offices in black tie, rolling his eyes as he waved goodbye to him. "Benefit," he'd say as an explanation. "Party. Wedding. Dinner." After these visits, he is always exhausted, but still he walks 7 blocks south and 1/4 block east to the Irvines. For months he had avoided the Irvines, and then last month, on the 1-year anniversary, They had asked him and Richard and J.B. to dinner at their house, and he knew he would have to go. It was the weekend after Labor Day. The previous 4 weeks, 4 weeks that had included the day Willem would have turned 53, the day that Willem had died, had been some of the worst he had ever experienced. He had known they would be bad. He had tried to plan accordingly. The firm had needed someone to go to Beijing, and although he knew he should have stayed in New York, he was working on a case that needed him more than the business in Beijing did. He volunteered anyway, and off he went. At first he had hoped he might be safe. The woolly numbness of jet lag was sometimes indistinguishable from the woolly numbness of his grief, and there were other things that were so physically uncomfortable, including the heat, which was woolly itself, woolly and sodden, that he had thought he would be able to distract himself. But then one night, near the end of the trip, he was being driven back to the hotel room from a long day of meetings, and he had looked out of the car window and had seen, glittering over the road, a massive billboard of Willem's face. It was a beer ad that Willem had shot 2 years ago, one that was only displayed throughout East Asia. But hanging from the top of the billboard were people on pulleys, and he realized that they were painting over the ad, that they were erasing Willem's face. Suddenly his breath left him, and he had almost asked the driver to stop, but he wouldn't have been able to. They were on a loop of road, one with no exits or places to pull over, and so he'd had to sit very still, his heart erupting within him, counting the beats it took to reach the hotel, thank the driver, get out, walk through the lobby, ride the elevator, walk down the hallway, and enter his room, where, before he could think, he was throwing himself against the cold marble wall of the shower, his mouth open and his eyes shut, tossing and tossing himself until he was in so much pain that his every vertebrae felt as if it had been jolted out of its sockets. That night he cut himself wildly, uncontrollably, and when he was shaking too badly to continue, he waited and cleaned the floor and drank some juice to give himself some energy, and then started again. After 3 rounds of this, he crept to the corner of the shower stall and wept, folding his arms over his head, making his hair tacky with blood, and that night he slept there, covered with a towel instead of a blanket. He had done this sometimes when he was a child, and had felt like he was exploding, separating from himself like a dying star, and would feel the need to tuck himself into the smallest space he could find so his very bones would stay knit together. Then he would carefully work himself out from beneath Brother Luke and bawl himself on the filthy motel carpet under the bed, which was prickly with burrs and dropped thumbtacks and slimy with used condoms and strange damp spots. Or he would sleep in the bathtub or in the closet, beetled up as tight as he was able. "My poor potato bug," Brother Luke would say when he found him like this. "Why are you doing this, Jude?" He had been gentle and worried, but he had never been able to explain it. Somehow he made it through that trip. Somehow he had made it through a year. The night of Willem's death, he dreamed of glass vases imploding, of Willem's body being projected through the air, of his face shattering against the tree. He woke missing Willem so profoundly that he felt he was going blind. The day after he returned home, he saw the first of the posters for the Happy Years, which had reverted to its original title, The Dancer and the Stage. Some of these posters were of Willem's face, his hair longish like Nureyev's, and his top scooped low on his chest, his neck long and powerful. And some were of just monumental images of a foot, Willem's actual foot, he happened to know, in a toe shoe, en pointe, shot so close you could see its veins and hairs, its thin, straining muscles and fat, bulging tendons. "Opening Thanksgiving Day," the posters read. Oh, God, he thought, and had gone back inside. Oh, God. He wanted the reminders to stop. He dreaded the day when they would. In recent weeks, he'd had the sense that Willem was receding from him, even as his grief refused to diminish in intensity. The next week, they went to the Irvines. They had decided, in some unspoken way, that they should go up together, and they met at Richard's apartment, and he gave Richard the keys to the car, and Richard drove them. They were all silent, even J.B., and he was very nervous. He had the sense that the Irvines were angry at him. He had the sense he deserved their anger. Dinner was all of Malcolm's favorite foods, and as they ate, he could feel Mr. Irvine staring at him and wondered whether he was thinking what he himself always thought. Why Malcolm? Why not him? Mrs. Irvine had suggested that they all go around the table and share a memory of Malcolm, and he had sat, listening to the others. Mrs. Irvine, who had told a story about how they had been visiting the Pantheon when Malcolm was 6, and how, 5 minutes after they had left, they had realized that Malcolm was missing, and had rushed back to find him sitting on the ground, gazing and gazing at the oculus. Flora, who told a story about how, as a second grader, Malcolm had appropriated her dollhouse from the attic, removed all the dolls, and filled it with little objects, dozens of chairs and tables and sofas, and even pieces of furniture that had no name, that he had made with clay. J.B., the story of how they had all returned to Hood one Thanksgiving, a day early, and had broken into the dormitory so they could have it to themselves, and how Malcolm had built a fire in the living room's fireplace so they could roast sausages for dinner. And when it was his turn, he told the story of how, back at Lispenard Street, Malcolm had built them a set of bookcases, which had partitioned their squish of a living room into such a meager sliver that when you were sitting on the sofa and stretched your legs out, you stretched them into the bookcase itself. But he had wanted the shelves, and Willem had said he could. And so over Malcolm had come with the cheapest wood possible, leftovers from the lumberyard, and he and Willem had taken the wood to the roof and assembled the bookcase there so the neighbors wouldn't complain about the banging, and then they had brought it back down and installed it. But when they did, Malcolm had realized that he'd mismeasured, and the bookcases were 3 inches too wide, which caused the edge of the unit to jut into the hallway. He hadn't minded, and neither had Willem, but Malcolm had wanted to fix it. "Don't, Mal," they had both told him. "It's great, it's fine." "It's not great," Malcolm had said, mopily. "It's not fine." Finally, they had managed to convince him, and Malcolm had left. He and Willem painted the case a bright vermilion and loaded it with their books. And then, early the next Sunday, Malcolm appeared again, looking determined. "I can't stop thinking about this," he said. And he'd set his bag down on the floor and drawn out a hacksaw and had started gnawing away at the structure, the two of them shouting at him until they realized that he was going to alter it whether they helped him or not. So back up to the roof went the bookcase, back down, once again it came, and this time it was perfect. "I always think of that incident," he said, as the others listened, "because it says so much about how seriously Malcolm took his work, and how he always strove to be perfect in it, to respect the material, whether it was marble or plywood. But I also think it says so much about how much he respected space, any space, even a horrible, unfixable, depressing apartment in Chinatown. Even that space deserved respect. And it says so much about how much he respected his friends, how much he wanted us all to live somewhere he imagined for us, someplace as beautiful and vivid as his imaginary houses were to him." He stopped. What he wanted to say, But what he didn't think he could get through was what he had overheard Malcolm say as Willem was complaining about hefting the bookcase back into place, and he was in the bathroom gathering the brushes and paint from beneath the sink.
"If I had left it like it was, he could have tripped against it and fallen, Willem,"
Malcolm had whispered.
"Would you want that?"
"No," Willem had said, after a pause, sounding ashamed. "No, of course not. You're right, Mal." Malcolm, he realized, had been the first among them to recognize that he was disabled. Malcolm had known this even before he did. He had always been conscious of it, but he had never made him feel self-conscious. Malcolm had sought only to make his life easier, and he had once resented him for this. As they were leaving for the night, Mr. Irvine put his hand on his shoulder. "Jude, will you stay behind for a bit?" he asked. "I'll have Monroe drive you home." He had to agree, and so he did, telling Richard he could take the car back to Green Street. For a while they sat in the living room, just he and Mr. Irvine. Malcolm's mother remained in the dining room with Flora and her husband and children, talking about his health and Mr. Irvine's health and Harold and his work, when Mr. Irvine began to cry. He had stood then and had sat down again next to Mr. Irvine and placed his hand hesitantly on his back, feeling awkward and shy, feeling the decades slip away from beneath them. Mr. Irvine had always been such an intimidating figure to all of them throughout their adulthoods. His height, his self-possession, his large, hard features. He looked like something from an Edward Curtis photograph, and that was what they all called him. The chief.
"What's the chief gonna say about this, Ma?"
J.B. had asked when Malcolm told them he was going to quit Ratstar, and they were all trying to urge temperance. Or J.B. again.
"Mal, can you ask the chief if I can use the apartment when I'm passing through Paris next month?"
But Mr. Irvine was no longer the chief. Although he was still logical and upright, he was 89, and his dark eyes had turned that same unnameable gray that only the very young or the very old possess. The color of the sea from which one comes, the color of the sea to which one returns. "I loved him," Mr. Irvine told him. "You know that, Jude, right? You know I did."
"I do," he said.
It was what he had always told Malcolm.
"Of course your dad loves you, Mal. Of course he does. Parents love their kids."
And once, when Malcolm was very upset, he could no longer remember why, he had snapped at him,
"Like you'd know anything about that, Jude."
And there had been a silence, and then Malcolm, horrified, had begun apologizing to him.
"I'm sorry, Jude," he'd said. "I'm so sorry."
And he'd had nothing to say, because Malcolm was right. He didn't know anything about that. What he knew from books, and books lied. They made things prettier. It had been the worst thing Malcolm had ever said to him. And although he had never mentioned it to Malcolm again, Malcolm had mentioned it to him once, shortly after the adoption.
"I will never forget that thing I said to you," he'd said.
"Mal, forget it," he'd told him, although he knew exactly what Malcolm was referring to.
"You were upset. It was a long time ago."
"But it was wrong," Malcolm had said, "and I was wrong, on every level." As he sat with Mr. Irvine, he thought, "I wish Malcolm could have had this moment. This moment should have been Malcolm's." And so now he visits the Irvines after visiting Lucien, and the visits are not dissimilar. They are both drifts into the past. They are both old men talking at him about memories he doesn't share, about contexts with which he is unfamiliar. But although these visits depress him, he feels he must fulfill them. Both are with people who had always given him time and conversation when he had needed it, but hadn't known how to ask for it. When he was 25 and new to the city,
He had lived at the Irvines, and Mr. Irvine would talk to him about the market and law and had given him advice. Not advice about how to think as much as advice about how to be a curiosity in a world in which curiosities weren't often tolerated. "People are going to think certain things about you because of how you walk," Mr. Irvine had once said to him, and he had looked down. "No," he'd said. "Don't look down, Jude. It's nothing to be ashamed of. You're a brilliant man, and you'll be brilliant, and you'll be rewarded for your brilliance. But if you act like you don't belong, if you act like you're apologetic for your own self, then people will start to treat you that way too." He'd taken a deep breath. "Believe me, be as steely as you want to be," Mr. Irvine had said. "Don't try to get people to like you. Never try to make yourself more palatable in order to make your colleagues more comfortable." Harold had taught him how to think as a litigator, but Mr. Irvine had taught him how to behave as one. And Lucian had recognized both of these abilities and had appreciated them both as well. That afternoon, his visit at the Irvines is brief because Mr. Irvine is tired, and on his way out he sees Flora, fabulous Flora, of whom Malcolm was so proud and so envious, and they speak for a few minutes before he leaves. It is early October, but still warm, the mornings like summer, but the afternoons turning dark and wintry, and as he walks up Park to his car, he remembers how he used to spend his Saturdays here 20 years ago, more. Then he would walk home, and on his way, he would occasionally stop by a famous, pricey bakery on Madison Avenue that he liked and buy a loaf of walnut bread. A single loaf cost as much as he was willing to spend on a dinner back then, that he and Willem would eat with butter and salt. The bakery is still there, and now he veers west off Park to go buy a loaf, which somehow seems to have remained fixed in price, at least in his memory, while everything else has grown so much more expensive. Until he began his Saturday visits to Lucian and the Irvines, he couldn't remember the last time he was in this neighborhood in daytime. His appointments with Andy are in the evenings. And now he lingers, looking at the pretty children running down the wide, clean sidewalks, their pretty mothers strolling behind them, the linden trees above him, shading their leaves into a pale, reluctant yellow. He passes 75th Street, where he once tutored Felix. Felix, who is now, unbelievably, 33, and no longer a singer in a punk band, but, even more unbelievably, a hedge fund manager as his father once was. At the apartment, he cuts the bread, slices some cheese, brings the plate to the table, and stares at it. He is making a real effort to eat real meals, to resume the habits and practices of the living. But eating has become somehow difficult for him. His appetite has disappeared, and everything tastes like paste, or like the powdered mashed potatoes they had served at the home. He tries, though. Eating is easier when he has to perform for an audience, and so he has dinner every Friday with Andy and every Saturday with JB. And he has started appearing every Sunday evening at Richard's. Together, the two of them cook one of Richard's Kaylee vegetarian meals, and then India joins them at the table. He has also resumed reading the paper, and now he pushes aside the bread and cheese and opens the arts section cautiously, as if it might bite him. 2 Sundays ago, he had been feeling confident and had snapped open the first page and had been confronted with a story about the film that Willem was to have begun shooting the previous September. The piece was about how the movie had been recast and how there was strong early critical support for it and how the main character had been renamed for Willem. And he had shut the paper and had gone to his bed and had held a pillow over his head until he was able to stand again. He knows that for the next 2 years, he will be confronted by articles, posters, signs, commercials, for films Willem was to have been shooting in these past 12 months. But today there is nothing in the paper other than a full-page advertisement for the dancer and the stage, and he stares at Willem's almost life-size face for a long, long time, holding his hand over its eyes and then lifting it off. If this were a movie, he thinks, the face would start speaking to him. If this were a movie, he would look up and Willem would be standing before him. Sometimes he thinks, I am doing better. I am getting better. Sometimes he wakes full of fortitude and vigor. Today will be the day, he thinks. Today will be the first day I really get better. Today will be the day I miss Willem less. And then something will happen. Something as simple as walking into his closet and seeing the lonely waiting stand of Willem's shirts that will never be worn again. And his ambition, his hopefulness, will dissolve, and he will be cast into despair once again. Sometimes he thinks, I can do this. But more and more now, he knows, I can't. He has made a promise to himself to every day find a new reason to keep going. Some of these reasons are little reasons. They are tastes he likes. They are symphonies he likes. They are paintings he likes, buildings he likes, operas and books he likes, places he wants to see, either again or for the first time. Some of these reasons are obligations, because he should, because he can, because Willem would want him to. And some of the reasons are big reasons, because of Richard, because of JB, because of Julia, and especially because of Harold. A little less than a year after he had tried to kill himself, he and Harold had taken a walk. It was Labor Day. They were in Truro. He remembers that he was having trouble walking that weekend. He remembers stepping carefully through the dunes. He remembers feeling Harold trying not to touch him, trying not to help him. Finally, they had sat and rested and looked out toward the ocean and talked. About a case he was working on, about Lawrence, who was retiring, about Harold's new book. And then suddenly, Harold had said, Jude, you have to promise me you won't do that again. And it was Harold's tone, stern, where Harold was rarely stern, that made him look at him. Harold, he began. I try not to ask you for anything, Harold said. Because I don't want you to think you owe me anything. And you don't. He turned and looked at him, and his expression, too, was stern. But I'm asking you this. I'm asking you. You have to promise me. He hesitated. I promise, he said, finally. And Harold nodded. Thank you, he said. They had never discussed this conversation again. And although he knew it wasn't quite logical, he didn't want to break this promise to Harold. At times it seemed that this promise, this verbal contract, was the only real deterrent to his trying again, although he knew that if he were to do it again, it wouldn't be an attempt. This time he would really do it. He knew how he'd do it. He knew it would work. Since Willem had died, he had thought about it almost daily. He knew the timeline he'd need to follow. He knew how he would arrange to be found. 2 months ago, in a very bad week, he had even rewritten his will so that it now read as the document of someone who had died with apologies to make, whose bequests would be attempts to ask for forgiveness. And although he isn't intending to honor this will, as he reminds himself, he hasn't changed it either. He hopes for infection, something swift and fatal, something that will kill him and leave him blameless. But there is no infection. Since his amputations, there have been no wounds. He is still in pain, but no more, less, actually, than he had been in before. He is cured, or at least as cured as he will ever be. So there is no real reason for him to see Andy once a week, but he does anyway, because he knows Andy is worried he will kill himself. He is worried he will kill himself. And so every Friday, he goes uptown. Most of these Fridays are just dinner dates, except for the second Friday of the month, when their dinner is preceded by an appointment. Here, everything is the same. Only his missing feet, his missing calves are proof that things have changed. In other ways, he has reverted to the person he was decades before. He is self-conscious again. He is scared to be touched. 3 years before Willem died, he had finally been able to ask him to massage the cream into the scars on his back, and Willem had done so. And for a while, he had felt different, like a snake who had grown a new skin. But now, of course, there is no one to help him, and the scars are once again tight and bulky, webbing his back in a series of elastic restraints. He knows now. People don't change. He cannot change. Willem had thought himself transformed by the experience of helping him through his recovery. He had been surprised by his own reserves, by his own forbearance. But he and everyone else, had always known that Willem had possessed those characteristics already. Those months may have clarified Willem to himself, but the qualities he had discovered had been a surprise to nobody but Willem. And in the same way, his losing Willem had been clarifying as well. In his years with Willem, he had been able to convince himself that he was someone else, someone happier, someone freer and braver. But now Willem is gone, and he is again who he was 20, 30, 40 years ago. And so, another Friday, he goes to Andy's. The scale, Andy sighing. The questions, his replies, a series of yeses and noes. Yes, he feels fine. No, no more pain than usual. No, no sign of wounds. Yes, an episode every 10 days to 2 weeks. Yes, he's been sleeping. Yes, he's been seeing people. Yes, he's been eating. Yes, 3 meals a day. Yes, every day. No, he doesn't know why he then keeps losing weight. No, he doesn't want to consider seeing Dr. Lohman again. The inspection of his arms. Andy turning them in his hands, looking for new cuts, not finding any. The week after he returned from Beijing, the week after he had lost control, Andy had looked at them and gasped, and he had looked down too, and had remembered how bad it had been at times, how insane it had gotten. But Andy hadn't said anything, just cleaned him up, and after he had finished, he had held both of his hands in both of his. A year, Andy had said. A year, he had echoed, and they had both been silent. After the appointment, they go around the corner to a small Italian restaurant that they like. Andy is always watching him at these dinners, and if he thinks he's not ordering enough food, he orders an additional dish for him and then badgers him until he eats it. But at this dinner, he can tell Andy is anxious about something. As they wait for their food, Andy drinks, quickly, and talks to him about football, which he knows he doesn't care about and never discusses with him. Andy had talked about sports with Willem sometimes, and he would listen to them argue over one team or another as they sat at the dining table eating pistachios, and he prepared dessert. Sorry, Andy says, at last. I'm babbling. Their appetizers arrive, and they eat quietly before Andy takes a breath. Jude, he says, I'm giving up the practice. He has been cutting into his eggplant, but now he stops, puts down his fork. Not anytime soon, Andy adds, quickly. Not for another 3 years or so, but I'm bringing in a partner this year so the transition process will be as smooth as possible. For the staff, but especially for my patients. He'll take over more and more of the patient load with each year. He pauses. I think you'll like him. I know you will. I'm going to stay your doctor until the day I leave, and I'll give you lots of notice before I do. but I want you to meet him and see if there's any sort of chemistry between you two. Andy smiles a bit, but he can't bring himself to smile back. And if there's not, for whatever reason, then we'll have plenty of time to find you someone else. I have a couple of other people in mind who I know would be amenable to giving you the full service treatment, and I won't leave until we get you settled somewhere. He still can't say anything, can't even lift his head to look at Andy. Jude, he hears Andy say, softly, pleadingly, I wish I could stay forever for your sake. You're the only one I wish I could stay for. But I'm tired. I'm almost 62, and I always swore to myself I'd retire before I turned 65. But he stops him. Andy, he says, of course you should retire when you want to. You don't owe me an explanation. I'm happy for you. I am. I'm just going to miss you. You've been so good to me. He pauses. I'm so dependent on you, he admits at last. Jude, Andy begins, and then is silent. Jude, I'll always be your friend. I'll always be here to help you, medically or otherwise. But you need someone who can grow old with you. This guy I'm bringing in is 46. He'll be around to treat you for the rest of your life, if you want him. As long as I die in the next 19 years, he hears himself saying. There's another silence. I'm sorry, Andy, he says, appalled by how wretched he feels, how pettily he is behaving. He has always known, after all, that Andy would retire at some point. But he realizes now that he had never thought he would be alive to see it. I'm sorry, he repeats. Don't listen to me. Jude, Andy says, quietly. I'll always be here for you, in one way or another. I promised you way back when, and I still mean it now. Look, Jude, he continues, after a pause, I know this isn't going to be easy. I know that no one else is going to be able to recreate our history. I'm not being arrogant. I just don't think anyone else is going to totally understand, necessarily. But we'll get as close as we can. And who couldn't love you? Andy smiles again, but once more he can't smile back. Either way, I want you to come meet this new guy, Linus. He's a good doctor, and just as important, a good person. I won't tell him any of your specifics. I just want you to meet him, all right? So the next Friday he goes uptown, and in Andy's office is another man, short and handsome, and with a smile that reminds him of Willem's. Andy introduces them, and they shake hands. I've heard so much about you, Jude, Linus says. It's a pleasure to meet you, finally. You too, he says. Congratulations. Andy leaves them to talk, and they do, a little awkwardly, joking about how this meeting seems like a blind date. Linus has been told only about his amputations, and they discuss them briefly, and the osteomyelitis that had preceded them. Those treatments can be a killer, Linus says, but he doesn't offer his sympathy for his lost legs, which he appreciates. Linus had been a doctor at a group practice that he'd heard Andy mention before. He seems genuinely admiring of Andy and excited to be working with him. There is nothing wrong with Linus. He can tell by the questions he asks and the respect with which he asks them that he is indeed a good doctor and probably a good person. But he also knows he will never be able to undress in front of Linus. He can't imagine having the discussions he has with Andy with anyone else. He can't imagine allowing anyone else such access to his body, to his fears. When he thinks of someone seeing his body anew, he quails. Ever since the amputation, he has only looked at himself once. He watches Linus's face, his unsettlingly Willem-like smile, and although he is only 5 years older than Linus, he feels centuries older. Something broken and desiccated. Something that anyone would look at and quickly throw the tarpaulin over once more. Take this one away, they'd say. It's junked. He thinks of the conversations he will need to have, the explanations he will need to give about his back, his arms, his legs, his diseases. He is so sick of his own fears, his own trepidations. But as tired as he is of them, he also cannot stop himself from indulging. He thinks of Linus paging slowly through his chart, of seeing the years, the decades of notes Andy has made about him, lists of his cuts, of his wounds, of the medications he has been on, of the flare-ups of his infections, notes on his suicide attempt, on Andy's pleas to get him to see Dr. Lohman. He knows Andy has chronicled all of this. He knows how meticulous he is. "You have to tell someone," Anna used to say. And as he had grown older, he had decided to interpret this sentence literally. Someone. Someday, he thought, somehow, he would find a way to tell someone, one person. And then he had. Someone he had trusted. And that person had died. And he didn't have the fortitude to tell his story ever again. But then, didn't everyone only tell their lives, truly tell their lives, to one person? How often could he really be expected to repeat himself, when with each telling he was stripping the clothes from his skin and the flesh from his bones, until he was as vulnerable as a small pink mouse? He knows, then, that he will never be able to go to another doctor. He will go to Andy for as long as he can, for as long as Andy will let him. And after that, he doesn't know. He will figure out what to do then. For now, his privacy, his life, is still his. For now, no one else needs to know. His thoughts are so occupied with Willem, trying to recreate him, to hold his face and voice in his head, to keep him present, that his past is as far away as it has ever been. He is in the middle of a lake, trying to stay afloat. He can't think of returning to shore and having to live among his memories again. He doesn't want to go to dinner with Andy that night, but they do, telling Linus goodbye as they leave. They walk to the sushi restaurant in silence, sit in silence, order, and wait in silence. "What did you think?" Andy finally asks. "He kind of looks like Willem," he says.
"Does he?"
Andy says, and he shrugs.
"A little," he says. "The smile."
"Ah," Andy says.
"I guess. I can see that."
There's another silence.
"But what did you think? I know it's sometimes hard to tell from one meeting, but does he seem like someone you might be able to get along with?"
"I don't think so, Andy," he says at last, and can feel Andy's disappointment.
"Really, Jude? What didn't you like about him?"
But he doesn't answer, and finally Andy sighs.
"I'm sorry," he says. "I hoped you might feel comfortable enough around him to at least consider it. Will you think about it anyway? Maybe you'll give him another chance. And in the meantime, there's this other guy, Stefan Wu, who I think you should maybe meet. He's not an orthopod, but I actually think that might be better. He's certainly the best internist I've ever worked with. Or there's this guy named—"
"Jesus, Andy, stop," he says, and he can hear the anger in his voice, anger he hasn't known he had.
"Stop."
He looks up, sees Andy's stricken face.
"Are you so eager to get rid of me? Can't you give me a break? Can't you let me take this in for a while? Don't you understand how hard this is for me?"
He knows how selfish, how unreasonable, how self-absorbed he is being, and he is miserable, but unable to stop himself, and he stands, bumping against the table.
"Leave me alone," he tells Andy. "If you're not going to be here for me, then leave me alone."
"Jude," Andy says, but he has already pushed past the table, and as he does, the waitress arrives with the food, and he can hear Andy curse and see him reach for his wallet, and he stumbles out of the restaurant.
Mr. Ahmed doesn't work on Fridays because he drives himself to Andy's. But now, instead of returning to the car, which is parked in front of Andy's office, he hails a taxi and gets in quickly and leaves before Andy can catch him. That night, he turns off his phones, drugs himself, crawls into bed. He wakes the next day, texts both JB and Richard that he's not feeling well, and has to cancel his dinners with them, and then redrugs himself until it is Monday. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. He has ignored all of Andy's calls and texts and emails, all of his messages, but although he is no longer angry, only ashamed, he cannot bear to make one more apology, cannot bear his own meanness, his own weakness. "I'm frightened, Andy," he wants to say. "What will I do without you?" Andy loves sweets, and on Thursday afternoon, he has one of his secretaries place an order for an absurd, a stupid amount of chocolates from Andy's favorite candy shop. "Any note?" his secretary asks, and he shakes his head. "No," he says, "just my name." She nods and starts to leave, and he calls her back, grabs a piece of notepaper from his desk, and scribbles, "Andy, I'm so embarrassed. Please forgive me. Jude," and hands it to her. But the next night he doesn't go to see Andy. He goes home to make dinner for Harold, who is in town on one of his unannounced visits. The previous spring had been Harold's final semester, which he had failed to register until it was September. He and Willem had always spoken of throwing Harold a party when he finally retired, the way they had done for Julia when she had retired. But he had forgotten, and he had done nothing. And then he remembered, and he still did nothing. He is tired. He doesn't want to see Harold. But he makes dinner anyway, a dinner he knows he will not eat, and serves it to Harold and then sits down himself. "Aren't you hungry?" Harold asks him, and he shakes his head. "I ate lunch at 5 today," he lies. "I'll eat later." He watches Harold eat and sees that he is old, that the skin on his hands has become as soft and satiny as a baby's. He is ever more aware that he is 1 year older, 2 years older, and now 6 years older than Harold was when they met. And yet for all these years, Harold has remained in his perception stubbornly 45. The only thing that has changed is his perception of how old exactly 45 is. It is embarrassing to admit this to himself, but it is only recently that he has begun considering that there is a possibility, even a probability, that he will outlive Harold. He has already lived beyond his imaginings. Isn't it likely he will live longer still? He remembers a conversation they'd had when he turned 35. "I'm middle-aged," he'd said, and Harold had laughed. "You're young," he'd said. "You're so young, Jude. You're only middle-aged if you plan on dying at 70. And you'd better not. I'm really not going to be in the mood to attend your funeral."
"You're going to be 95," he said. "Are you really planning on still being alive then?"
"Alive and frisky, and being attended to by an assortment of buxom young nurses, and not in any mood to go to some long-winded service." He had finally smiled.
"And who's paying for this fleet of buxom young nurses?"
"You, of course," said Harold. "You and your big pharma spoils." But now he worries that this won't happen after all. "Don't leave me, Harold," he thinks. But it is a dull, spiritless request, one he doesn't expect will be answered, made more from rote than from real hope. "Don't leave me." "You're not saying anything," Harold says now, and he refocuses himself.
"I'm sorry, Harold," he says. "I was drifting a little."
"I can see that," Harold says. "I was saying, Julie and I were thinking of spending some more time here, in the city, of living uptown full-time." He blinks.
"You mean moving here?"
Well, we'll keep the place in Cambridge, Harold says. But yes, I'm considering teaching a seminar at Columbia next fall, and we like spending time here. He looks at him. We thought it'd be nice to be closer to you, too. He isn't sure what he thinks about this.
But what about your lives up there?
He asks. He is discomfited by this news. Harold and Julia love Cambridge. He has never thought they would leave.
What about Lawrence and Jillian?
Lawrence and Jillian are always coming through the city. So is everyone else. Harold studies him again. You don't seem very happy about this, Jude.
I'm sorry, he says, looking down. But I just hope you're not moving here because of me.
There's a silence.
I don't mean to sound presumptuous, he says, finally. But if it is because of me, then you shouldn't, Harold. I'm fine. I'm doing fine.
Are you, Jude? Harold asks, very quietly. And he suddenly stands, quickly, and goes to the bathroom near the kitchen, where he sits on the toilet seat and puts his face in his hands. He can hear Harold waiting on the other side of the door, but he says nothing, and neither does Harold. Finally, minutes later, when he's able to compose himself, he opens the door again, and the two of them look at each other.
I'm 51, he tells Harold.
What's that supposed to mean? Harold asks.
It means I can take care of myself, he says. It means I don't need anyone to help me.
Harold sighs. Jude, he says. There's not an expiration date on needing help or needing people. You don't get to a certain age and it stops. They're quiet again. You're so thin, Harold continues, and when he doesn't say anything.
What does Andy say? I can't keep having this conversation,
he says at last, his voice scraped and hoarse.
I can't, Harold, and you can't either. I feel like all I do is disappoint you, and I'm sorry for that. I'm sorry for all of it. But I'm really trying. I'm doing the best I can. I'm sorry if it's not good enough.
Harold tries to interject, but he talks over him.
This is who I am. This is it, Harold. I'm sorry I'm such a problem for you. I'm sorry I'm ruining your retirement. I'm sorry I'm not happier. I'm sorry I'm not over Willem. I'm sorry I have a job you don't respect. I'm sorry I'm such a nothing of a person.
He no longer knows what he is saying. He no longer knows how he feels. He wants to cut himself, to disappear, to lie down and never get up again, to hurl himself into space. He hates himself. He pities himself. He hates himself for pitying himself.
I think you should go, he says. I think you should leave.
Jude, Harold says. Please go, he says.
Please, I'm tired. I need to be left alone. Please leave me alone.
And he turns from Harold and stands, waiting, until he hears Harold walk away from him. After Harold leaves, he takes the elevator to the roof. Here there is a stone wall, chest high, that lines the perimeter of the building, and he leans against it, swallowing the cool air, placing his palms flat against the top of the wall to try to stop them from shaking. He thinks of Willem, of how he and Willem used to stand on this roof at night, not saying anything, just looking down into other people's apartments. From the southern end of the roof, they could almost see the roof of their old building on Lisbonard Street, and sometimes they would pretend that they could see not just the building, but them within it, their former selves performing a theater of their daily lives.
There must be a fold in the space-time continuum,
Willem would say in his action hero voice.
You're here beside me, and yet I can see you moving around in that shithole apartment. My God, St. Francis, do you realize what's going on here?
Back then, he would always laugh. But remembering this now,
He cannot. These days, his only pleasure is thoughts of Willem, and yet those same thoughts are also his greatest source of sorrow. He wishes he could forget as completely as Lucian has, that Willem ever existed, his life with him. As he stands on the roof, he considers what he has done. He has been irrational. He has gotten angry at someone who has once again offered to help him, someone he is grateful for, someone he owes, someone he loves. Why am I acting like this? He thinks. But there's no answer. Let me get better, he asks. Let me get better or let me end it. He feels that he is in a cold cement room from which prong several exits, and one by one, he is shutting the doors, closing himself in the room, eliminating his chances for escape. But why is he doing this? Why is he trapping himself in this place he hates and fears when there are other places he could go? This, he thinks, is his punishment for depending on others. One by one they will leave him, and he will be alone again. And this time it will be worse because he will remember it had once been better. He has the sense, once again, that his life is moving backward, that it is becoming smaller and smaller, the cement box shrinking around him until he is left with a space so cramped that he must fold himself into a crouch. Because if he lies down, the ceiling will lower itself upon him and he will be smothered. Before he goes to bed, he writes Harold a note, apologizing for his behavior. He works through Saturday, he sleeps through Sunday, and a new week begins. On Tuesday, he gets a message from Todd. The first of the lawsuits are being settled for massive figures, but even Todd knows enough not to ask him to celebrate. His messages, by phone or by email, are clipped and sober. The name of the company that is ready to settle, the proposed amount, a short congratulations. On Wednesday, he is meant to stop by the artist's non-profit where he still does pro bono work, but he instead meets J.B. downtown at the Whitney, where his retrospective is being hung. This show is another souvenir from the ghosted past. It has been in the planning stages for almost 2 years. When J.B. had told them about it, the three of them had thrown a small party for him at Green Street. "Well, J.B., you know what this means, right?" Willem had asked, gesturing toward the two paintings, Willem and the Girl, and Willem and Jude, Lispinard Street 2, from J.B.'s first show, which hung side by side in their living room. "As soon as the show comes down, all of these pieces are going straight to Christie's." And everyone had laughed, J.B. hardest of all, proud and delighted and relieved. Those pieces, along with Willem, London, October 8, 9:08 a.m., from Seconds, Minutes, Hours, Days, which he had bought, and Jude, New York, October 14, 7:02 a.m., which Willem had, along with the ones they owned from Everyone I've Ever Known, and The Narcissist's Guide to Self-Hatred, and Frog and Toad, and all the drawings, the paintings, the sketches of J.B.'s that the two of them had been given and had kept, some since college, will be in the Whitney exhibit, as well as previously unshown work. There will also be a concurrent show of new paintings at J.B.'s gallery, and 3 weekends before, he had gone to J.B.'s studio in Greenpoint to see them. The series is called The Golden Anniversary, and it is a chronicle of J.B.'s parents' lives, both together, before he was born, and in an imagined future, the two of them living on and on together into old age. In reality, J.B.'s mother is still alive, as are his aunts, but in these paintings, so too is J.B.'s father, who had actually died at the age of 36. The series is just 16 paintings, many of them smaller in scale than J.B.'s previous works, and as he walked through J.B.'s studio, looking at these scenes of domestic fantasy, his 60-year-old father coring an apple while his mother made a sandwich, his 70-year-old father sitting on the sofa reading the paper
while in the background his mother's legs can be seen descending a flight of stairs. He couldn't help but see what his life, too, was and might have been. It was precisely these scenes he missed the most from his own life with Willem, the forgettable, in-between moments in which nothing seemed to be happening, but whose absence was singularly unfillable. Interspersing the portraits were still lifes of the objects that had made JB's parents' lives together. Two pillows on a bed, both slightly depressed as if someone had dragged the back of a spoon through a bowl of clotted cream. Two coffee cups, one's edge faintly pinked with lipstick. A single picture frame containing a photograph of a teenage JB with his father, the only appearance JB made in these paintings. And seeing these images, he once again marveled at how perfect JB's understanding was of a life together, of his life, of how everything in his apartment, Willem's sweatpants still slung over the edge of the laundry hamper, Willem's toothbrush still waiting in the glass on the bathroom sink, Willem's watch, its face splintered from the accident, still sitting untouched on his nightstand, had become totemic, a series of runes only he could read. The table next to Willem's side of the bed at Lantern House had become a sort of unintentional shrine to him. There was the mug he had last drunk from, and the black-framed glasses he'd recently started wearing, and the book he was reading, still splayed face down in the position he'd left it. "Oh, JB," he had sighed, and although he had wanted to say something else, he couldn't, but JB had thanked him anyway. They were quieter around each other now, and he didn't know if this was who JB had become, or if this was who JB had become around him. Now he knocks on the museum's doors and is let in by one of JB's studio assistants, who is waiting for him and who tells him that JB is overseeing the installation on the top floor, but says he should start on the 6th floor and work his way up to meet him, and so he does. The galleries on this floor are dedicated to JB's early works, including Juvenilia. There is a whole grid of framed drawings from JB's childhood, including a math test over which JB had drawn lovely little pencil portraits of, presumably, his classmates. 8- and 9-year-olds bent over their desks, eating candy bars, feeding birds. He had neglected to solve any of the problems, and at the top of the page was a bright red F along with a note. "Dear Mrs. Marion, you see what the problem is here. Please come see me. Sincerely, Jamie Greenberg. P.S. Your son is an immense talent." He smiles looking at this, the first time he can feel himself smiling in a long time. In a lucite cube on a stand in the middle of the room are a few objects from The Quotidian, including the hair-covered hairbrush that JB had never returned to him, and he smiles again, looking at them, thinking of their weekends devoted to searching for clippings. The rest of the floor is given over to images from The Boys, and he walks slowly through the rooms, looking at pictures of Malcolm, of him, of Willem. Here are the two of them in their bedroom at Lispenard Street, both of them sitting on their twin beds, staring straight into JB's camera, Willem with a small smile. Here they are again at the card table, he working on a brief, Willem reading a book. Here they are at a party. Here they are at another party. Here he is with Phaedra. Here Willem is with Richard. Here is Malcolm with his sister, Malcolm with his parents. Here is Jude with cigarette, and here is Jude after sickness. Here is a wall with pen and ink sketches of these images, sketches of them. Here are the photographs that inspired the paintings. Here is the photograph of him from which Jude with cigarette was painted. Here he is, that expression on his face, that hunch of his shoulders, a stranger to himself, and yet instantly recognizable to himself as well. The stairwells between the floors are densely hung with interstitial pieces, drawings and small paintings, studies and experimentations that J.B. made between bodies of work. He sees the portrait J.B. made of him for Harold and Julia, for his adoption. He sees drawings of him in Truro, of him in Cambridge, of Harold and Julia. Here are the four of them. Here are J.B.'s aunts and mother and grandmother. Here is the chief and Mrs. Irvine. Here is Flora. Here is Richard and Ali and the Henry Youngs and Phaedra. The next floor, everyone I've ever known, everyone I've ever loved, everyone I've ever hated, everyone I've ever fucked, seconds, minutes, hours, days. Behind him, around him, installers mill, making small adjustments with their white-gloved hands, standing back and staring at the walls. Once again, he enters the stairwell. Once again, he looks up, and there he sees, again and again, drawings of him, of his face, of him standing, of him in his wheelchair, of him with Willem, of him alone. These are pieces that J.B. had made when they weren't speaking, when he had abandoned J.B. There are drawings of other people as well, but they are mostly of him, him and Jackson. Again and again, Jackson and him, a checkerboard of the two of them. The images of him are wistful, faint, pencils and pen and inks and watercolors. The ones of Jackson are acrylics, thick-lined, looser and angrier. There is one drawing of him that is very small, on a postcard-sized piece of paper, and when he examines it more closely, he sees that something had been written on it, and then erased. "Dear Jude," he makes out, "please." But there is nothing more after that word. He turns away, his breathing quick, and sees the watercolor of a camellia bush that J.B. had sent him when he was in the hospital, after he had tried to kill himself. The next floor, The Narcissist's Guide to Self-Hatred. This had been J.B.'s least commercially successful show, and he can understand why. To look at these works, their insistent anger and self-loathing, was to be both awed and made almost unbearably uncomfortable. The coon, one painting was called. The buffoon. The bojangler. The step and fetch it. In each, J.B., his skin shined and dark, his eyes bulging and yellowed, dances or howls or cackles, his gums awful and huge and fish flesh pink, while in the background, Jackson and his friends emerge half-formed from a gloom of Goyen browns and grays, all crowing at him, clapping their hands and pointing and laughing. The last painting in this series was called Even Monkeys Get the Blues, and it was of J.B. wearing a pert red fez and a shrunken red epauletted jacket, pantsless, hopping on one leg in an empty warehouse. He lingers on this floor, staring at these paintings, blinking, his throat shutting, and then slowly moves to the stairs a final time. Then he is on the top floor, and here there are more people, and for a while he stands to the side, watching J.B. talking to the curators and his gallerist, laughing and gesturing. These galleries are hung mostly with images from Frog and Toad, and he moves from each to each, not really seeing them, but rather remembering the experience of viewing them for the first time in J.B.'s studio, when he and Willem were new to each other, when he felt as if he was growing new body parts, a second heart, a second brain, to accommodate this excess of feeling, the wonder of his life. He is staring at one of the paintings when J.B. finally sees him and comes over, and he hugs J.B. tightly and congratulates him. "J.B.," he says, "I'm so proud of you." "Thanks, Judy,"
J.B. says, smiling. I'm proud of me too, goddammit. And then he stops smiling. I wish they were here, he says. He shakes his head. I do too, he manages to say. For a while they are silent. Then, come here, J.B. says, and grabs his hand and pulls him to the far side of the floor, past J.B.'s gallerist, who waves at him, past a final crate of framed drawings that are being unboxed, to a wall where a canvas is having its skin of bubble wrap carefully cut away from it. J.B. positions them before it, and when the plastic is unpeeled, he sees it is a painting of Willem. The piece isn't large, just 4 feet by 3 feet, and is horizontally oriented. It is by far the most sharply photorealistic painting J.B. has produced in years, the colors rich and dense, the brushstrokes that made Willem's hair feathery fine. The Willem in this painting looks like Willem did shortly before he died. He thinks he is seeing Willem in the months before or after shooting The Dancer in the Stage, for which his hair was longer and darker than it was in life. After Dancer, he decides, because the sweater he is wearing, a black-green the color of magnolia leaves, is one he remembers buying for Willem in Paris when he went to visit him there. He steps back, still looking. In the painting, Willem's torso is directed toward the viewer, but his face is turned to the right so that he is almost in profile, and he is leaning toward something or someone and smiling. And because he knows Willem smiles, he knows Willem has been captured looking at something he loves. He knows Willem in that instant was happy. Willem's face and neck dominate the canvas, and although the background is suggested rather than shown, he knows that Willem is at their table. He knows it from the way J.B. has drawn the light and shadows on Willem's face. He has the sense that if he says Willem's name, then the face in the painting will turn toward him and answer. He has the sense that if he stretches his hand out and strokes the canvas, he will feel beneath his fingertips Willem's hair, his fringe of eyelashes. But he doesn't do this, of course. Just looks up, at last, and sees J.B. smiling at him sadly. The title card's been mounted already, J.B. says, and he goes slowly to the wall behind the painting and sees its title. Willem listening to Jude tell a story. Green Street. And he feels his breath abandon him. It feels as if his heart is made of something oozing and cold, like ground meat, and it is being squeezed inside a fist so that chunks of it are falling, plopping to the ground near his feet. He is abruptly dizzy. I need to sit, he finally says. And J.B. takes him around the corner, to the other side of the wall where Willem will hang, where there's a small cul-de-sac. He half sits atop one of the crates that's been left there and hangs his head, resting his hands on his thighs. I'm sorry, he manages to say. I'm sorry, J.B. It's for you, J.B. says, quietly. When the show comes down, Jude, it's yours. Thank you, J.B., he says. He makes himself stand upright, feels everything within him shift. I need to eat something, he thinks. When was the last time he ate? Breakfast, he thinks, but yesterday. He reaches his hand out toward the crate to center himself, to stop the rocking he feels within his head and spine. He feels this sensation more and more frequently, a floating away, a state close to ecstasy. Take me somewhere, he hears a voice inside him say. But he doesn't know to whom he is saying this, or where he wants to go. Take me. Take me. He is thinking this, crossing his arms over himself, when J.B. suddenly grabs him by his shoulders and kisses him on the mouth. He wrenches away.
What the hell are you doing?
He asks, and he fumbles backward, rubbing his mouth with the back of his hand.
Jude, I'm sorry. I didn't mean anything, J.B. says. You just look so...
so sad.
So this is what you do?
He spits at JB, who steps toward him.
Don't you dare touch me, JB.
In the background, he can hear the chatter of the installers, JB's gallerist, the curators. He takes another step, this time toward the edge of the wall. I'm going to faint, he thinks, but he doesn't. Jude, JB says, and then, his face changing.
Jude?
But he is moving away from him.
Get away from me, he says. Don't touch me. Leave me alone.
Jude, JB says in a low voice, following him.
You don't look good. Let me help you.
But he keeps walking, trying to get away from JB.
I'm sorry, Jude, JB continues. I'm sorry.
He is aware of the pack of people moving as a clump to the other side of the floor, hardly noticing him leaving, JB next to him. It is as if they don't exist. 20 more steps to the elevators, he estimates. 18 more steps. 16. 15. 14. Beneath him, the floor has become a loosely spinning top, wobbling on its axis. 10. 9. 8.
Jude, says JB, who won't stop talking. Let me help you. Why won't you talk to me anymore?
He is at the elevator. He smacks the button with his palm. He leans against the wall, praying he'll be able to stay upright.
Get away from me,
he hisses at JB.
Leave me alone.
The elevator arrives. The door is open. He steps toward them. His walk now is different. He still leads with his left leg, always, and he still lifts it unnaturally high. That hasn't changed. That has been dictated by his injury. But he no longer drags his right leg, and because his prosthetic feet are so well articulated, much more so than his own feet had been, he is able to feel the roll of his foot as it leaves the floor. The complicated, beautiful pad of laying itself down on the ground again, section by section. But when he is tired, when he is desperate, he finds himself unconsciously reverting to his old gait, with each foot landing flatly, slabbily on the floor, with his right leg listing behind him. And as he steps into the elevator, he forgets that his steel and fiberglass legs are made for more nuance than he is allowing them. And he trips and falls.
Jude!
He hears JB call out. And because he is so weak, for a moment, everything is dark and empty. And when he regains his vision, he sees that the flock of people have heard JB cry out, that they are now walking in his direction. He sees as well JB's face above him, but he is too tired to interpret his expression. Willem listening to Jude tell a story, he thinks, and before him appears the painting. Willem's face, Willem's smile, but Willem isn't looking at him. He is looking somewhere else. What if, he thinks, the Willem of the painting is in fact looking for him? He has a sudden urge to stand to the painting's right, to sit in a chair in what would be Willem's sightline, to never leave that painting by itself. There is Willem, imprisoned forever in a one-sided conversation. Here he is, in life, imprisoned as well. He thinks of Willem alone in his painting, night after night in the empty museum, waiting and waiting for him to tell him a story. Forgive me, Willem, he tells Willem in his head. Forgive me, but I have to leave you now. Forgive me, but I have to go.
Jude,
JB says. The elevator doors are closing, but JB reaches his arm out to him. But he ignores it, works himself to his feet, leans into the corner of the elevator car. The people are very close now. Everyone moves so much faster than he does. Stay away from me, he says to JB. but he is quiet. Leave me alone. Please leave me alone. Jude, JB says again. I'm sorry. And he begins to say something else. But as he does, the elevator doors close, and he is left alone at last.
Chapter 3. He didn't begin it consciously. He really didn't. And yet when he comprehends what he is doing, he doesn't stop it either. It is the middle of November, and he is getting out of the pool after his morning swim, and as he's lifting himself up on the metal bars that Richard had installed around the pool to help him get in and out of his wheelchair, the world disappears. When he wakes again, it's only 10 minutes later. One moment it was 6:45 a.m., and he was pulling himself up. The next it is 6:55 a.m., and he is prone on the black rubber floor, his arms reaching forward for the chair, his torso leaving a wet splotch on the ground. He groans, moving into a sitting position, and waits until the room rights itself again before attempting, and this time succeeding, to hoist himself up. The second time comes a few days later. He has just gotten home from the office, and it is late. Increasingly, he has begun to feel as if Rosen Pritchard supplies him with his very energy, and once he leaves its premises, so too does his strength. The moment Mr. Ahmed shuts the back door of the car, he is asleep, and he doesn't wake until he is delivered to Green Street. But as he walks into the dark, quiet apartment that night, he is overcome by a sense of displacement, one so debilitating that for a moment he stops, blinking and confused, before he moves to the sofa in the living room and lies down. He means to just rest, just for a few minutes, just until he can stand again. But when he opens his eyes next, it is day, and the living room is gray with light. The third time is Monday morning. He wakes before his alarm, and although he is lying down, he feels everything around him and within him roiling, as if he is a bottle half filled with water set adrift on an ocean of clouds. In recent weeks, he hasn't had to drug himself at all on Sundays. He gets home from dinner with JB on Saturday and climbs into bed, and only wakes when Richard comes to find him the next day. When Richard doesn't come, as he hadn't this Sunday, he and India are visiting her parents in New Mexico. He sleeps through the entire day, through the entire night. He dreams of nothing, and nothing wakes him. He knows what is happening, of course. He isn't eating enough. He hasn't been for months. Some days he eats very little, a piece of fruit, a piece of bread, and some days he eats nothing at all. It isn't as if he has decided to stop eating. It is simply that he is no longer interested, that he no longer can. He isn't hungry, so he doesn't eat. That Monday, though, he does. He gets up, he totters downstairs. He swims, but poorly, slowly. And then he comes back upstairs, he makes himself breakfast. He sits and eats it, staring into the apartment, the newspapers folded on the table beside him. He opens his mouth. He inserts a forkful of food, he chews, he swallows. He keeps his movements mechanical, but suddenly he thinks of how grotesque a process it is, putting something into his mouth, moving it around with his tongue, swallowing down the saliva-clotted plug of it, and he stops. Still, he promises himself, I will eat, even if I don't want to, because I am alive. And this is what I am to do. But he forgets, and forgets again. And then, 2 days later, something happens. He has just come home, so exhausted that he feels soluble, as if he is evaporating into the air, so insubstantial that he feels made not of blood and bone, but of vapor and fog, when he sees Willem standing before him. He opens his mouth to speak to him, but then he blinks, and Willem is gone, and he is teetering, his arms stretched before him.
Willem, he says aloud into the empty apartment. Willem. He closes his eyes,
as if he might conjure him that way. But Willem doesn't reappear. The next day, however, he does. He is once again at home. It is once again night. He has once again not eaten anything. He is lying in bed. He is staring into the dark of the room. And there, abruptly, is Willem, shimmery as a hologram, the edges of him blurring with light. And although Willem isn't looking at him, he is looking elsewhere, looking toward the doorway, looking so intently that he wants to follow Willem's sightline, to see what Willem sees. But he knows he mustn't blink, he mustn't turn away, or Willem will leave him. It is enough to see him, to feel that he in some way still exists, that his disappearance might not be a permanent state after all. But finally he has to blink, and Willem vanishes once more. However, he isn't too upset, because now he knows, if he doesn't eat, if he can last to the point just before collapse, he will begin having hallucinations, and his hallucinations might be of Willem. That night he falls asleep contented, the first time he has felt contentment in nearly 15 months, because now he knows how to recall Willem. Now he knows his ability to summon Willem is within his control. He cancels his appointment with Andy so he can stay home and experiment. This is the third consecutive Friday he hasn't seen Andy. Since that night at the restaurant, the two of them have been polite with each other, and Andy hasn't mentioned Linus or any other doctor again, although he has said he'll raise the subject anew in 6 months. "It's not a matter of wanting to get rid of you, Jude," he said. "And I'm sorry. I really am, if that's how it sounded. I'm just worried. I just want to make sure we find someone you like, someone I know you'll be comfortable with." "I know, Andy," he said. "And I appreciate it. I do. I've been behaving badly, and I took it out on you." But he knows now that he has to be careful. He has tasted anger, and he knows he has to control it. He can feel it, waiting to burst from his mouth in a swarm of stinging black flies. Where has this rage been hiding, he wonders. How can he make it disappear? Lately his dreams have been of violence, of terrible things befalling the people he hates, the people he loves. He sees Brother Luke being stuffed into a sack full of squealing, starved rats. He sees JB's head being slammed against a wall, his brain splashing out in a gray slurry. In the dreams, he is always there, dispassionate and watchful, and after witnessing their destruction, he turns and walks away. He wakes with his nose bleeding, the way it had when he was a child and was suppressing a tantrum, with his hand shaking, with his face contorted into a snarl. That Friday, Willem doesn't come to him after all. But the next evening, as he is leaving the office to meet JB for dinner, he turns his head to the right and sees, sitting next to him in the car, Willem. This time, he fancies, Willem is a little harder edged, a little more solid, and he stares and stares until he blinks, and Willem once again dissolves. After these episodes, he is depleted, and the world around him dims, as if all its power and electricity has gone toward creating Willem. He instructs Mr. Ahmed to take him home instead of to the restaurant. As he is driven south, he texts JB to tell him he's feeling sick and can't make it. He is doing this more and more, canceling plans with people, shoddily and usually unforgivably late, an hour before a hard-to-secure dinner reservation, minutes after a scheduled meeting time at a gallery, seconds before the curtain rises above a stage. Richard, JB, Andy, Harold, and Julia, these are the final people who still contact him, persistently, week after week. He can't remember when he last heard from Citizen, or Rhodes, or the Henry Youngs, or Elijah, or Phaedra. It has been weeks, at least. And although he knows he should care, he doesn't. His hope, his energy,
are no longer replenishable resources. His reserves are limited, and he wants to spend them trying to find Willem, even if the hunt is elusive, even if he is likely to fail. And so home he goes, and he waits and waits for Willem to appear to him. But he doesn't, and finally he sleeps. The next day he waits in bed, trying to suspend himself between alertness and dazedness, for that, he thinks, is the state in which he is most likely to summon Willem. On Monday he wakes, feeling foolish. "This has got to stop," he tells himself. "You have got to rejoin the living. You're acting like an insane person. Visions? Do you know what you sound like?" He thinks of the monastery, where Brother Pavel liked to tell him the story of an 11th century nun named Hildegard. Hildegard had visions. She closed her eyes, and illuminated objects appeared before her. Her days were a swim with light. But Brother Pavel was less interested in Hildegard than in Hildegard's instructor, Jutta, who had forsaken the material world to live as an ascetic in a small cell, dead to the concerns of the living, alive but not alive. "That's what will happen to you if you don't obey," Pavel would say, and he would be terrified. There was a small tool shed on the monastery's grounds, dark and chilly and jumbled with malevolent-looking iron objects, each of them ending in a spike, a spear, a scythe. And when the brother told him of Jutta, he imagined he would be forced into the tool shed, fed just enough to survive, and on and on and on he would live, almost forgotten, but not completely, almost dead, but not completely. But even Jutta had had Hildegard for company. He would have no one. How frightened he had been. How certain he was that this, someday, would come to pass. Now, as he lies in bed, he hears the old Leet murmur to him. "I have become lost to the world," he sings quietly, "in which I otherwise wasted so much time." But although he knows how foolish he is being, he still cannot bring himself to eat. The very act of it now repels him. He wishes he were above want, above need. He has a vision of his life as a sliver of soap, worn and used and smoothed into a slender, blunt-ended arrowhead, a little more of it disintegrating with every day. And then there is what he doesn't like to admit himself, but is conscious of thinking. He cannot break his promise to Harold. He won't. But if he stops eating, if he stops trying, the end will be the same anyway. Usually he knows how melodramatic, how narcissistic, how unrealistic he is being, and at least once a day he scolds himself. The fact is, he finds himself less and less able to summon Willem's specifics without depending on props. He cannot remember what Willem's voice sounds like without first playing one of the saved voice messages. He can no longer remember Willem's scent without first smelling one of his shirts. And so he fears he is grieving not so much for Willem, but for his own life, its smallness, its worthlessness. He has never been concerned with his legacy, or never thought he had been. And it is a helpful thing that he isn't, for he will leave nothing behind, not buildings or paintings or films or sculptures, not books, not papers, not people. Not a spouse, not children, probably not parents, and, if he keeps behaving the way he is, not friends. Not even new law. He has created nothing. He has made nothing. Nothing but money. The money he has earned. The money given to him to compensate for Willem being taken from him. His apartment will revert to Richard. The other properties will be given away or sold, and their proceeds donated to charities. His art will go to museums, his books to libraries, his furniture to whoever wants it. It will be as if he has never existed. He has the feeling, unhappy as it is, that he was at his most valuable in those motel rooms, where he was at least something singular and meaningful to someone. Although what he had to offer was being taken from him, not given willingly. But there, he had at least been real to another person. What they saw him as was actually what he was. There, he was at his least deceptive. He had never been able to truly believe Willem's interpretation of him, as someone who was brave and resourceful and admirable. Willem would say those things and he would feel ashamed, as if he'd been swindling him. Who was this person Willem was describing? Even his confession hadn't changed Willem's perception of him. In fact, Willem seemed to respect him more, not less, because of it, which he had never understood, but in which he had allowed himself to find solace. But although he hadn't been convinced, it was somehow sustaining that someone else had seen him as a worthwhile person, that someone had seen his as a meaningful life. The spring before Willem died, they'd had some people over for dinner, just the four of them and Richard and Asian Henry Young, and Malcolm, in one of the occasional spikes of regret he had been experiencing over his and Sophie's decision not to have children, even though, as they all reminded him, they hadn't wanted children to begin with, had asked, "Without them, I just wonder, what's been the point of it all? Don't you guys ever worry about this? How do any of us know our lives are meaningful?" "Excuse me, Mal," Richard had said, pouring him the last of the wine from one bottle as Willem uncorked another. "But I find that offensive. Are you saying our lives are less meaningful because we don't have kids?" "No," Malcolm said. Then he thought, "Well, maybe." "I know my life's meaningful," Willem had said suddenly, and Richard had smiled at him. "Of course your life's meaningful," J.B. had said. "You make things people actually want to see, unlike me and Malcolm and Richard and Henry here." "People want to see our stuff," said Asian Henry Young, sounding wounded. "I meant people outside of New York and London and Tokyo and Berlin." "Oh, them. But who cares about those people?" "No," Willem said, after they'd all stopped laughing. "I know my life's meaningful because..." And here he stopped and looked shy and was silent for a moment before he continued. "Because I'm a good friend. I love my friends, and I care about them, and I think I make them happy." The room became quiet, and for a few seconds he and Willem had looked at each other across the table, and the rest of the people, the apartment itself, fell away. They were two people on two chairs, and around them was nothingness. "To Willem," he finally said, and raised his glass, and so did everyone else. "To Willem," they all echoed, and Willem smiled back at him. Later that evening, when everyone had left and they were in bed, he had told Willem that he was right. "I'm glad you know your life has meaning," he told him. "I'm glad it's not something I have to convince you of. I'm glad you know how wonderful you are." "But your life has just as much meaning as mine," Willem had said. "You're wonderful too. Don't you know that, Jude?" At the time, he had muttered something that Willem might interpret as an agreement. But as Willem slept, he lay awake. It had always seemed to him a very plush kind of a problem, a privilege, really, to consider whether life was meaningful or not. He didn't think his was, but this didn't bother him so much. And although he hadn't fretted over whether his life was worthwhile, he had always wondered why so many others, went on living at all. It had been difficult to convince himself at times, and yet so many people, so many millions, billions of people, lived in misery he couldn't fathom, with deprivations and illnesses that were obscene in their extremity. And yet on and on and on they went. So was the determination to keep living not a choice at all, but an evolutionary implementation? Was there something in the mind itself, a constellation of neurons as toughened and scarred as a tendon, that prevented humans from doing what logic so often argued they should? And yet that instinct wasn't infallible. He had overcome it once. But what had happened to it after? Had it weakened or become more resilient? Was his life even his to choose to live any longer? He had known ever since the hospital that it was impossible to convince someone to live for his own sake. But he often thought it would be a more effective treatment to make people feel more urgently the necessity of living for others. That, to him, was always the most compelling argument. The fact was, he did owe Harold. He did owe Willem. And if they wanted him to stay alive, then he would. At the time, as he slogged through day after day, his motivations had been murky to him. But now he could recognize that he had done it for them. And that rare selflessness had been something he could be proud of after all. He hadn't understood why they wanted him to stay alive, only that they had, and so he had done it. Eventually he had learned how to rediscover contentment, joy even, but it hadn't begun that way. And now he is once again finding life more and more difficult, each day a little less possible than the last. In his every day stands a tree, black and dying, with a single branch jutting to its right, a scarecrow's soul prosthetic, and it is from this branch that he hangs. Above him a rain is always misting, which makes the branch slippery, but he clings to it, as tired as he is, because beneath him is a hole bored into the earth so deep that he cannot see where it ends. He is petrified to let go because he will fall into the hole. But eventually he knows he will. He knows he must. He is so tired. His grasp weakens a bit, just a little bit, with every week. So it is with guilt and regret, but also with a sense of inevitability, that he cheats on his promise to Harold. He cheats when he tells Harold he is being sent away to Jakarta for business, and will miss Thanksgiving. He cheats when he begins growing a beard, which he hopes will disguise the gauntness in his face. He cheats when he tells Sanjay he's fine, he's just had an intestinal flu. He cheats when he tells his secretary she doesn't need to get him lunch because he picked something up on the way into the office. He cheats when he cancels the next month's worth of dates with Richard and JB and Andy, telling them he has too much work. He cheats every time he lets the voice whisper to him, unbidden, "It won't be long now. It won't be long." He isn't so deluded that he thinks he will be able to literally starve himself to death, but he does think that there will be a day, closer now than ever before, in which he will be so weak that he will stumble and fall and crash his head against the Green Street lobby's cement floors, in which he will contract a virus and not have the resources to make it retreat. At least one of his lies is true. He does have too much work. He has an appellate argument in a month, and he is relieved to be able to spend so much time at Rosen Pritchard, where nothing bad has ever befallen him, where even Willem knows not to disturb him with one of his unpredictable appearances. One night, he hears Sanjay muttering to himself as he hurries past his office, "Fuck, she's going to kill me," and looks up and sees it is no longer night, but day, and the Hudson is turning a smeary orange. He notes this, but he feels nothing. Here, his life suspends itself. Here he might be anyone, anywhere. He can stay as late as he likes. No one is waiting for him. No one will be disappointed if he doesn't call. No one will be angry if he doesn't go home. The Friday before the trial, he is working late, when one of his secretaries looks in to tell him he has a visitor in the lobby, a doctor contractor, and would he like him sent up. He pauses, unsure of what to do. Andy has been calling him, but he hasn't been returning his calls, and he knows he won't simply leave. "Yes," he tells her. "Bring him to the Southeastern Conference Room." He waits in this conference room, which has no windows and is the most private, and when Andy comes in, he sees his mouth tighten. But they shake hands like strangers, and it's not until his secretary leaves that Andy gets up and walks over to him. "Stand up," he commands.
"I can't," he says.
"Why not?"
"My legs hurt," he says.
But this isn't true. He cannot stand because his prostheses no longer fit. The good thing about these prostheses is that they're very sensitive and lightweight, the prosthetist had told him when he was fitted for them. The bad thing is that the sockets don't allow you very much give. You lose or gain more than 10% of your body weight, so for you that's plus or minus 14, 15 pounds, and you're either going to need to adjust your weight or have a new set made. So it's important you stay at weight. For the past 3 weeks, he has been in his wheelchair, and although he continues to wear his legs, they are only for show, something to fill his pants with. They are too ill-fitting for him to actually use, and he is too weary to see the prosthetist, too weary to have the conversation he knows he'll need to have with him, too weary to conjure explanations. "I think you're lying," Andy says.
"I think you've lost so much weight that your prostheses are sliding off of you, am I right?"
But he doesn't answer.
"How much weight have you lost, Jude?"
Andy asks.
"When I last saw you, you were already 12 pounds down. How much is it now? 20? More?"
There's another silence.
"What the hell are you doing?"
Andy asks, lowering his voice further.
"What are you doing to yourself, Jude?"
"You look like hell,"
Andy continues.
"You look terrible. You look sick."
He stops.
"Say something," he says. "Say something, goddammit, Jude."
He knows how this interaction is meant to go. Andy yells at him. He yells back at Andy. A detente, one that ultimately changes nothing, one that is a piece of pantomime, is reached. He will submit to something that isn't a solution, but that makes Andy feel better. And then something worse will happen, and the pantomime will be revealed to be just that, and he will be coerced into a treatment he doesn't want. Harold will be called. He will be lectured and lectured and lectured, and he will lie and lie and lie. The same cycle, the same circle, again and again and again. A churn as predictable as the men in the motel rooms coming in, fitting their sheets over the bed, having sex with him, leaving, and then the next one, and the next one. And the next day, the same. His life is a series of dreary patterns. Sex, cutting, this, that. Visits to Andy, visits to the hospital. Not this time, he thinks. This is when he does something different. This is when he escapes. "You're right, Andy," he says, in as calm and unemotive a voice as he can summon, the voice he uses in the courtroom. "I've lost weight, and I'm sorry I haven't come in earlier. I didn't because I knew you'd get upset. But I've had a really bad intestinal flu, one I just can't shake. But it's ended. I'm eating, I promise. I know I look terrible, but I promise I'm working on it." Ironically, he has been eating more in the past 2 weeks. He needs to get through the trial. He doesn't want to faint while he's in court. And after that, what can Andy say? He is suspicious still, but there is nothing for him to do.
"If you don't come see me next week, I'm coming back,"
Andy tells him before his secretary sees him out.
"Fine,"
he says, still pleasantly.
"The Tuesday after next. The trial will be over by then."
After Andy leaves, he feels momentarily triumphant, as if he is a hero in a fairy tale and has just vanquished a dangerous enemy. But of course Andy isn't his enemy, and he is being ridiculous, and his sense of victory is followed by despair. He feels, as he increasingly does, that his life is something that has happened to him, rather than something he has had any role in creating. He has never been able to imagine what his life might be. Even as a child, even as he dreamed of other places, of other lives,
He wasn't able to visualize what those other places and lives would be. He had believed everything he had been taught about who he was and what he would become. But his friends, Anna, Lucian, Harold, and Julia, they had imagined his life for him. They had seen him as something different than he had ever seen himself as. They had allowed him to believe in possibilities that he would never have conceived. He saw his life as the axiom of equality. But they saw it as another riddle, one with no name. Jude equals X. And they had filled in the X in ways Brother Luke, the counselors at the home, Dr. Traylor, had never written for him or encouraged him to write for himself. He wishes he could believe their proofs the way they do. He wishes they had shown him how they had arrived at their solutions. If he knew how they had solved the proof, he thinks, he would know why to keep living. All he needs is one answer. All he needs is to be convinced once. The proof needn't be elegant. It need only be explicable. The trial arrives. He does well. At home that Friday, he wheels himself into the bedroom, into bed. He spends the entire weekend in a sleep that is unfamiliar and eerie, less a sleep than a glide, weightlessly moving between the realms of memory and fantasy, unconsciousness and wakefulness, anxiety and hopefulness. This is not the world of dreams, he thinks, but someplace else. And although he is aware at moments of waking, he sees the chandelier above him, the sheets around him, the sofa with its wood fern print across from him. He is unable to distinguish when things have happened in his visions from when they have actually happened. He sees himself lifting a blade to his arm and slicing it down through his flesh, but what springs from the slit are coils of metal and stuffing and horsehair. And he realizes that he has undergone a mutation, that he is no longer even human, and he feels relief. He won't have to break his promise to Harold after all. He has been enchanted. His culpability has vanished with his humanity. Is this real? The voice asks him, tiny and hopeful. Are we inanimate now? But he can't answer himself. Again and again he sees Brother Luke, Dr. Traylor. As he has gotten weaker, as he has drifted from himself, he sees them more and more frequently. And although Willem and Malcolm have dimmed for him, Brother Luke and Dr. Traylor have not. He feels his past is a cancer, one he should have treated long ago, but instead ignored. And now Brother Luke and Dr. Traylor have metastasized. Now they are too large and too overwhelming for him to eliminate. Now when they appear, they are wordless. They stand before him. They sit side by side on the sofa in his bedroom, staring at him. And this is worse than if they spoke, because he knows they are trying to decide what to do with him. And he knows that whatever they decide will be worse than he can imagine, worse than what had happened before. At one point he sees them whispering to each other, and he knows they are talking about him. Stop! He yells at them. Stop! Stop! But they ignore him. And when he tries to get up and make them leave, he is unable to do so. Willem, he hears himself call. Protect me. Help me. Make them leave. Make them go away. But Willem doesn't come. And he realizes he is alone and becomes afraid, concealing himself under the blanket and remaining as still as he can, certain that time has doubled back upon itself and he will be made to relive his life in sequence. It'll get better eventually, he promises himself. Remember, good years followed the bad. But he can't do it again. He can't live once more through those 15 years. Those 15 years whose half-life have been so long and so resonant that have determined everything he has become and done. By the time he finally, fully wakes on Monday morning, he knows he has crossed some sort of threshold. He knows he is close, that he is moving from one world to another. He blacks out twice while simply trying to get into his wheelchair. He faints on his way to the bathroom. And yet somehow he remains uninjured. Somehow he is still alive. He gets dressed, the suit and shirts he'd had recut for him a month ago already loose, and slides his stumps into the prostheses and goes downstairs to meet Mr. Ahmed. At work, everything is the same. It is the new year. People are returning from their vacations. During the management committee meeting, he jabs his fingers into his thigh to keep himself alert. He feels his grip loosen around the branch. Sanjay leaves early that evening. He leaves early, too. Today is Harold and Julia's move-in day, and he has promised to go uptown to visit them. He hasn't seen them in more than a month, and although he feels himself no longer able to gauge what he looks like, he has dressed in extra layers today. An undershirt, his shirt, a sweater, a cardigan, his suit jacket, his coat, so that he'll appear a little bulkier. At Harold's, he is waved in by the doorman, and up he goes, trying not to blink because blinking makes the dizziness worse. Outside their door, he stops and puts his head in his hands until he feels strong enough, and then he turns the knob and rolls inside and stares. They are all there. Harold and Julia, of course, but Andy and J.B. and Richard and India and the Henry Youngs and Rhodes and Elijah and Sanjay and the Irvines as well, all posed and perched on different pieces of furniture as if they're at a photo shoot, and for a second he fears he will start laughing. And then he wonders, am I dreaming this? Am I awake? He remembers the vision of himself as a sagging mattress and thinks, am I still real? Am I still conscious? Christ, he says, when he is able to speak at last. What the hell is this? Exactly what you think it is, he hears Andy say. I'm not staying for this, he tries to say, but can't. He can't move. He can't look at any of them. He looks instead at his hands, his scarred left hand, his normal right. As above him, Andy speaks. They have been watching him for weeks. Sanjay has been keeping track of the days he's seen him eat at the office. Richard has been entering his apartment to check his refrigerator for food. We measure weight loss in grades, he hears Andy saying. A loss of 1 to 10% of your body weight is grade 1. A loss of 11 to 20% is grade 2. Grade 2 is when we consider putting you on a feeding tube. You know this, Jude, because it's happened to you before. And I can tell by looking at you that you're at grade 2, at least. Andy talks and talks, and he thinks he begins to cry, but he is unable to produce tears. Everything has gone so wrong, he thinks. How did everything go so wrong? How has he forgotten so completely who he was when he was with Willem? It is as if that person has died along with Willem, and what he is left with is his elemental self, someone he has never liked, someone so incapable of occupying the life he has, the life he has somehow made for himself, in spite of himself. Finally, he lifts his head and sees Harold staring at him, sees that Harold is actually crying, silently, looking and looking at him. Harold, he says, although Andy is still talking. Release me. Release me from my promise to you. Don't make me do this anymore. Don't make me go on. But no one releases him. Not Harold, not anyone. He is instead captured and taken to the hospital. And there, at the hospital, he begins to fight. My last fight, he thinks. And he fights harder than he ever has, as hard as he had as a child in the monastery, becoming the monster they always told him he was, yowling and spitting in Harold's and Andy's faces, ripping the IV from his hand, thrashing his body on the bed, trying to scratch at Richard's arms, until finally a nurse, cursing,
sticks him with a needle, and he is sedated. He wakes with his wrists strapped to the bed, with his prostheses gone, with his clothes gone as well, with a press of cotton against his collarbone under which he knows a catheter has been inserted. The same thing all over again, he thinks. The same, the same, the same. But this time it isn't the same. This time he is given no choices. This time he is put on a feeding tube, which punctures through his abdomen and into his stomach. This time he is made to go back and see Dr. Lohmann. This time he is going to be watched every mealtime. Richard will watch him eat breakfast. Sanjay will watch him eat lunch. And if he's at the office late, dinner. Harold will watch him on the weekends. He isn't allowed to go to the bathroom until an hour after he's finished each meal. He must see Andy every Friday. He must see JB every Saturday. He must see Richard every Sunday. He must see Harold whenever Harold says he must. If he is caught skipping a meal or a session or disposing of food in any way, he will be hospitalized. And this hospitalization won't be a matter of weeks. It will be a matter of months. He will gain a minimum of 30 pounds, and he will be allowed to stop only when he has maintained that weight for 6 months. And so begins his new life, a life in which he has moved past humiliation, past sorrow, past hope. This is a life in which his weary friends, weary faces, watch him as he eats omelets, sandwiches, salads, who sit across from him and watch as he twirls pasta around his fork, as he plows his spoon through polenta, as he slides flesh off bones, who look at his plate, at his bowl, and either nod at him, yes, he can go, or shake their heads, no, Jude, you have to eat more than that. At work, he makes decisions, and people follow them, and then at 1 p.m., lunch is delivered to his office, and for the next half hour, although no one else in the firm knows this, his decisions mean nothing, because Sanjay has absolute power, and he must obey whatever he says. Sanjay, with one text to Andy, can send him to the hospital, where they will tie him down again and force food into him. They all can. No one seems to care that this isn't what he wants. Have you all forgotten? He yearns to ask. Have you forgotten him? Have you forgotten how much I need him? Have you forgotten I don't know how to be alive without him? Who can teach me? Who can tell me what I should do now? It was an ultimatum that sent him to Dr. Lohmann the first time. It is an ultimatum that brings him back. He had always been cordial with Dr. Lohmann, cordial and remote, but now he is hostile and churlish. I don't want to be here, he says, when the doctor says he's happy to see him again and asks him what he would like to discuss. And don't lie to me. You're not happy to see me, and I'm not happy to be here. This is a waste of time. Yours and mine. I'm here under duress. We don't have to discuss why you're here, Jude. Not if you don't want to, Dr. Lohmann says. What would you like to talk about? Nothing, he snaps, and there is a silence. Tell me about Harold, Dr. Lohmann suggests, and he sighs impatiently. There's nothing to say, he says. He sees Dr. Lohmann every Monday and Thursday. On Monday nights, he returns to work after his appointment, but on Thursdays he is made to see Harold and Julia, and with them he is horrifically rude as well. And not just rude, but nasty, spiteful. He behaves in ways that astonish him, in ways he has never dared before in his life, not even when he was a child, in ways that he would have been beaten for by anyone else, but not by Harold and Julia. They never rebuke him. They never discipline him. This is disgusting, he says that night, pushing away the chicken stew Harold has made. I won't eat this. I'll get you something else, Julia says quickly, getting up. What do you want, Jude?
Do you want a sandwich? Some eggs?
Anything else, he says. This tastes like dog food. But he is speaking to Harold, staring at him, daring him to flinch, to break. His pulse leaps in his throat without anticipation. He can see Harold springing from his chair and hitting him in the face. He can see Harold crumpling with tears. He can see Harold ordering him out of his house.
Get the fuck out of here, Jude, Harold will say. Get out of our lives and never come back.
Fine, he'll say. Fine. Fine. I don't need you anyway, Harold. I don't need any of you. What a relief it will be to learn that Harold had never really wanted him after all. That his adoption was a whim, a folly, whose novelty tarnished long ago. But Harold does none of those things, just looks at him. Jude, he says at last, very quietly.
Jude, Jude!
He mocks him, squawking his own name back to Harold like a jay.
Jude, Jude!
He is so angry, so furious. There is no word for what he is. Hatred sizzles through his veins. Harold wants him to live. And now Harold is getting his wish. Now Harold is seeing him as he is.
Do you know how badly I could hurt you?
He wants to ask Harold.
Do you know I could say things that you would never forget? That you would never forgive me for? Do you know I have that power? Do you know that every day I have known you, I have been lying to you? Do you know what I really am? Do you know how many men I have been with? What I have let them do to me? The things that have been inside me, the noises I have made?
His life, the only thing that is his, is being possessed. By Harold, who wants to keep him alive. By the demons who scrabble through his body, dangling off his ribs, puncturing his lungs with their talons. By Brother Luke. By Dr. Traylor.
What is life for? He asks himself. What is my life for?
Oh, he thinks, will I never forget? Is this who I am after all? After all these years? He can feel his nose start to bleed, and he pushes back from the table.
I'm leaving, he tells them, as Julia enters the room with a sandwich.
He sees that she has cut off its crusts and sliced it into triangles, the way you would for a child. And for a second he wavers and almost begins to bawl. But then he recalls himself and glares again at Harold.
No, you're not, Harold says, not angrily, but decisively.
He stands up from his chair, points his finger at him.
You're staying and you're finishing.
No, I'm not, he announces. Call Andy, I don't care. I'm going to kill myself, Harold. I'm going to kill myself no matter what you do. And you're not going to be able to stop me.
Jude,
he hears Julia whisper.
Jude, please.
Harold walks over to him, taking the plate from Julia as he does. And he thinks, this is it. He raises his chin. He waits for Harold to hit him in the face with it, but he doesn't. Just puts the plate before him.
Eat, Harold says, his voice tight. You're going to eat this now.
He thinks, unexpectedly, of the day he had his first episode at Harold and Julia's. Julia was at the grocery store, and Harold was upstairs printing out a worrisomely complicated recipe for a souffle he claimed he was going to make. There he had lain in the pantry, trying to keep himself from kicking his legs out in agony, listening to Harold clatter down the stairs and into the kitchen.
Jude?
He'd called, and not seeing him, and as quiet as he had tried to be, he had made a noise anyway, and Harold had opened the door and found him. He had known Harold for 6 years by that point, but he was always careful around him, dreading but expecting the day when he would be revealed to him as he really was.
I'm sorry,
he'd tried to tell Harold, but he was only able to croak. Jude, Harold had said, frightened. Can you hear me? And he'd nodded, and Harold had entered the pantry himself, picking his way around the stacks of paper towels and jugs of dishwasher detergent, lowering himself to the floor and gently pulling his head into his lap. And for a second, he had thought that this was the moment he had always half anticipated, the one in which Harold would unzip his pants and he would have to do what he had always done. But he hadn't, had just stroked his head. And after a while, as he twitched and grunted, his body tensing itself with pain, its heat filling his joints, he realized that Harold was singing to him. It was a song he had never heard before, but that he recognized instinctually was a child's song, a lullaby. And he juddered and chattered and hissed through his teeth, opening and closing his left hand, gripping the throat of a nearby bottle of olive oil with his right, as on and on Harold sang, as he lay there, so desperately humiliated. He knew that after this incident, Harold would either become distant from him or would draw closer still. And because he didn't know which would happen, he found himself hoping, as he never had before and never would again, that this episode would never end, that Harold's song would never finish, that he would never have to learn what followed it. And now he is so much older. Harold is so much older. Julia is so much older. They are three old people, and he is being given a sandwich meant for a child, and a directive, eat, meant for a child as well. We are so old we have become young again, he thinks. And he picks up the plate and throws it against the far wall, where it shatters spectacularly. He sees the sandwich had been grilled cheese, sees one of the triangular slabs slap itself against the wall and then ooze down it, the white cheese dripping off in gluey clumps. Now, he thinks, almost giddily, as Harold comes close to him once more. Now. 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 And Harold raises his hand, and he waits to be hit so hard that this night will end, and he will wake in his own bed and for a while be able to forget this moment, will be able to forget what he has done. But instead he finds Harold wrapping him in his arms, and he tries to push him away, but Julia is holding him too, leaning over the carapace of his wheelchair, and he is trapped between them. Leave me alone! He roars at them. But his energy is dissipating, and he is weak and hungry. Leave me alone. He tries again, but his words are shapeless and useless as his arms, as his legs, and he soon stops trying. Jude, Harold says to him, quietly. My poor Jude. My poor sweetheart. And with that, he starts to cry, for no one has ever called him sweetheart, not since Brother Luke. Sometimes Willem would try, sweetheart, Willem would try to call him, honey, and he would make him stop. The endearment was filthy to him, a word of debasement and depravity. My sweetheart, Harold says again, and he wants him to stop. He wants him to never stop. My baby. And he cries and cries. Cries for everything he has been. For everything he might have been. For every old hurt. For every old happiness. Cries for the shame and joy of finally getting to be a child. With all of a child's whims and wants and insecurities. For the privilege of behaving badly and being forgiven. For the luxury of tendernesses, of fondnesses, of being served a meal and being made to eat it, for the ability at last, of believing a parent's reassurances, of believing that to someone he is special, despite all his mistakes and hatefulness, because of all his mistakes and hatefulness. It ends with Julia finally going to the kitchen and making another sandwich. It ends with him eating it.
truly hungry for the first time in months. It ends with him spending the night in the extra bedroom, with Harold and Julia kissing him goodnight. It ends with him wondering if maybe time really is going to loop back upon itself after all. Except in this rendering, he will have Julia and Harold as parents from the beginning. And who knows what he will be? Only that he will be better, that he will be healthier, that he will be kinder, that he won't feel the need to struggle so hard against his own life. He has a vision of himself as a 15-year-old, running into the house in Cambridge, shouting words, "Mom! Dad!" he has never said before. And although he can't imagine what would have made this dream self so excited, for all his study of normal children, their interests and behaviors, he knows few specifics. He understands that he is happy. Maybe he is wearing a soccer uniform, his arms and legs bare. Maybe he is accompanied by a friend, by a girlfriend. He has probably never had sex before. He is probably trying at every opportunity to do so. He would think sometimes of who he would be as an adult, but it would never occur to him that he might not have someone to love, sex, his own feet running across a field of grass as soft as carpet. All those hours he has spent cutting and hiding the cutting and beating back his memories. What would he do instead with all those hours? He would be a better person, he knows. He would be a more loving one. But maybe, he thinks, maybe it isn't too late. Maybe he can pretend one more time, and this last bout of pretending will change things for him, will make him into the person he might have been. He is 51. He is old. But maybe he still has time. Maybe he can still be repaired. He is thinking this on Monday, when he goes to see Dr. Lohmann, to whom he apologizes for his awful behavior the week before, and the weeks before that as well. And this time, for the first time, he really tries to talk to Dr. Lohmann. He tries to answer his questions, and to do so honestly. He tries to begin to tell a story he has only ever told once before. But it is very difficult, not only because the story is barely possible for him to speak, but because he cannot do so without thinking of Willem, and how, when he had last told this story, he was with someone who had seen him the way no one had since Anna, with someone who had managed to see past who he was, and yet see him completely as well. And then he is upset, breathless, and he turns his wheelchair sharply. He is still 6 or 7 pounds away from using his prostheses for walking again, and excuses himself and leaves Dr. Lohmann's office, spinning down the hall to the bathroom, where he locks himself in, breathing slowly and rubbing his palm against his chest as if to soothe his heart. And here in the bathroom, which is cold and silent, he plays his old game of if with himself. If I hadn't followed Brother Luke, if I hadn't let myself be taken by Dr. Traylor, if I hadn't let Caleb inside, if I had listened more to Anna. On he plays, his recriminations beating a rhythm in his head. But then he also thinks, if I had never met Willem, if I had never met Harold, if I had never met Julia or Andy or Malcolm or J.B., or Richard, or Lucian, or so many other people. Rhodes and Citizen and Phaedra and Elijah, the Henry Youngs, Sanjay. All the most terrifying ifs involve people. All the good ones do as well. Finally, he is able to calm himself, and he wheels himself out of the bathroom. He could leave, he knows. The elevator is there. He could send Mr. Ahmed back for his coat, but he doesn't. Instead, he goes the other direction and returns to the office, where Dr. Lohmann is still sitting in his chair, waiting for him. "Jude," says Dr. Lohmann, "you've come back." He takes a breath. "Yes," he says,
I've decided to stay.
Part 7. Lispinard Street. On the second anniversary of your death, we went to Rome. This was something of a coincidence, and also not. He knew and we knew he'd have to be out of the city, far away from New York State. And maybe the Irvines felt the same way, because that was when they had scheduled the ceremony, at the very end of August, when all of Europe had migrated elsewhere, and yet we were flying toward it. That continent bereft of all its chattering flocks, all its native fauna. It was at the American Academy where Sophie and Malcolm had both once had residencies, and where the Irvines had endowed a scholarship for a young architect. They had helped select the first recipient, a very tall and sweetly nervous young woman from London, who built mostly temporary structures, complex-looking buildings of earth and sod and paper that were meant to disintegrate slowly over time. And there was an announcement of the fellowship, which came with additional prize money, and a reception, at which Flora spoke. Along with us and Sophie and Malcolm's Belcast partners, there were Richard and J.B., both of whom had also had residencies in Rome. And after the ceremony, we went to a little restaurant nearby they had both liked when they had lived there. And Richard showed us which part of the building's walls were Etruscan and which were Roman. But although it was a nice meal, comfortable and convivial, it was also a quiet one. And at one point, I remember looking up and realizing that none of us were eating, and all of us were staring at the ceiling and our plates, at one another, and thinking something separate. And yet, I knew something the same as well. The next afternoon, Julia napped and we took a walk. We were staying across the river, near the Spanish Steps, but we had the car take us back over the bridge to Trastevere and walked through the streets that were so close and dark that they might have been hallways, until finally we came to a square, tiny and precise and adorned with nothing but sunlight, where we sat on a stone bench. An elderly man, with a white beard and wearing a linen suit, sat down on the other end, and he nodded at us, and we nodded at him. For a long time we were silent together, sitting in the heat, and then he suddenly said that he remembered this square, that he had been here with you once, and that there was a famous gelato place just two streets away. "Should I go?" he asked me, and I smiled. "I think you know the answer," I said, and he got up. "I'll be back," he said. "Stracciatella," I told him, and he nodded. "I know," he said. We watched him leave, the man and I, and then the man smiled at me and I smiled back. He wasn't so elderly after all, I saw. Probably just a few years older than I. And yet, I was never able, and am still not, to think of myself as old. I talked as if I knew I was. I bemoaned my age. But it was only for comedy, or to make other people feel young. "Lui è tuo figlio?" the man asked, and I nodded. I was always surprised and pleased when we were recognized for who we were to each other, for we looked nothing alike, he and I. And yet I thought, I hoped, there must have been something about the way we were together that was more compelling evidence of our relation than mere physical resemblance. "Ah," the man said, looking at him again before he turned the corner and disappeared from sight. "Molto bello." "Sì," I said, and was suddenly sad. He looked sly then, and asked, or rather stated, "Tua moglie deve essere molto bella, no?" And then grinned to show me he meant it in fun, that it was a compliment, that if I was a plain man, I was also a lucky one, to have such a beautiful wife who had given me such a handsome son. And so I couldn't be offended. I grinned back at him. "She is," I said, and he smiled, unsurprised. The man had already left by the time he returned, nodding at me as he went, leaning on his cane, with a cone for me and a container of lemon granita for Julia. I wished he had bought something for himself, too, but he hadn't. "We should go," he said.
And we did. And that night he went to bed early. And the following day, the day you died, we didn't see him at all. He left us a message at the front desk saying he had gone for a walk, and that he would see us tomorrow, and that he was sorry, and all day long we walked too. And although I thought there was a chance we might see him, Rome is not such a large city after all, we didn't. And that night as we undressed for bed, I was aware that I had been looking for him on every street, in every crowd. The next morning there he was at breakfast, reading the paper, pale but smiling at us. And we didn't ask him what he'd done the day before, and he didn't volunteer it. That day we just walked around the city, the three of us, an unwieldy little pack, too wide for the sidewalks. We strolled in single file, each of us taking the position of the leader in turn. But just to familiar places, well-trafficked places, places that would have no secret memories, that held no intimacies. Near Via Condotti, Julia looked into the tiny window of a tiny jewelry store, and we went inside, the three of us filling the space, and each held the earrings she had admired in the window. They were exquisite, solid gold, dense and heavy and shaped like birds, with small round rubies for eyes and little gold branches in their beaks. And he bought them for her. And she was embarrassed and delighted. Julia had never worn much jewelry. But he looked happy to be able to. And I was happy that he was happy. And that she was happy, too. That night we met J.B. and Richard for a final dinner. And the next morning we left to go north, to Florence, and he to go home. I'll see you in 5 days, I told him, and he nodded. Have a good time, he said. Have a wonderful time. I'll see you soon. He waved as we were driven away in the car. We turned in our seats to wave back at him. I remember hoping my wave was somehow telegraphing what I couldn't say. Don't you dare. The night before, as he and Julia were talking to J.B., I asked Richard if he would feel comfortable sending me updates while we were away, and Richard said he would. He had gained almost all the weight Andy wanted, but he'd had two setbacks, one in May, one in July, and so we were all still watching him. It sometimes felt as if we were living our relationship in reverse, and instead of worrying for him less, I worried for him more. With each year I became more aware of his fragility, less convinced of my competence. When Jacob was a baby, I would find myself feeling more assured with each month he lived, as if the longer he stayed in this world, the more deeply he would become anchored to it, as if by being alive he was staking claim to life itself. It was a preposterous notion, of course, and it was proven wrong in the most horrible way. But I couldn't stop thinking this, that life tethered life. And yet at some point in his life, after Caleb, if I had to date it, I had the sense that he was in a hot air balloon, one that was staked to the earth with a long, twisted rope, but each year the balloon strained and strained against its cords, tugging itself away, trying to drift into the skies. And down below there was a knot of us trying to pull the balloon back to the ground, back to safety. And so I was always frightened for him. And I was always frightened of him as well. Can you have a real relationship with someone you are frightened of? Of course you can. But he still scared me. Because he was the powerful one, and I was not. If he killed himself, if he took himself away from me, I knew I would survive. But I knew as well that survival would be a chore. I knew that forever after I would be hunting for explanations, sifting through the past to examine my mistakes. And of course I knew how badly I would miss him, because although there had been trial runs for his eventual departure, I had never been able to get any better at dealing with them, and I was never able to get used to them. But then we came home and everything was the same. Mr. Ahmed met us at the airport and drove us back to the apartment,
and waiting for us with the doorman were bags of food so we wouldn't have to go to the grocery store. The next day was a Thursday, and he came over and we had dinner, and he asked what we had seen and done, and we told him. That night we were washing the dishes, and as he was handing me a bowl to put in the dishwasher, it slipped through his fingers and broke against the floor.
"God damn it!"
he shouted. "I'm so sorry, Harold. I'm so stupid. I'm so clumsy." And although we told him it wasn't a problem, that it was fine, he only grew more and more upset. So upset that his hands started to shake, that his nose started to bleed. "Jude," I told him, "it's okay. It happens." But he shook his head. "No," he said, "it's me. I mess up everything. Everything I touch, I ruin." Julie and I had looked at each other over his head as he was picking up the pieces, unsure what to say or do. The reaction was so out of proportion to what had happened. But there had been a few incidents in the preceding months, ever since he had thrown that plate across the room, that made me realize, for the first time in my life with him, how truly angry he was, how hard he must work every day at controlling it. After that first incident with the plate, there had been another, a few weeks later. This was up at Lantern House, where he hadn't been in months. It was morning, just after breakfast, and Julie and I were leaving to go to the store, and I went to find him to ask what he wanted. He was in his bedroom, and the door was slightly ajar, and when I saw what he was doing, I for some reason didn't call his name, didn't walk away, but just stood outside the frame, silent and watching. He had one prosthesis on and was putting on the other. I had never seen him without them. And I watched as he sank his left leg into the socket, drawing the elastic sleeve up around his knee and thigh, and then pushed his pants leg down over it. As you know, these prostheses had feet with paneling that resembled the shape of a toe box and a heel, and I watched as he pulled on his socks and then his shoes. And then he took a breath and stood, and I watched as he took a step and then another. But even I could tell something was wrong. They were still too big. He was still too thin. And before I could call out, he had lost his balance and pitched forward onto the bed, where he lay still for a moment. And then he reached down and tore off both legs, one and then the other, and for a second, they were still wearing their socks and shoes. It appeared as if they were his real legs, and he had just yanked away a piece of himself, and I half expected to see an arcing splash of blood. But instead he picked one up and slammed it against the bed, again and again and again, grunting with the effort. And then he threw it to the ground and sat on the edge of the mattress, his face in his hands, his elbows on his thighs, rocking himself and not making a sound. "Please," I heard him say. "Please." But he didn't say anything else. And I, to my shame, crept away and went to our bedroom, where I sat in a posture that mimicked his own, and waited as well for something I didn't know. In those months I thought often of what I was trying to do, of how hard it is to keep alive someone who doesn't want to stay alive. First you try logic, you have so much to live for. And then you try guilt, you owe me. And then you try anger and threats and pleading. "I'm old. Don't do this to an old man." But then, once they agree, it is necessary that you, the cajoler, move into the realm of self-deception, because you can see that it is costing them. You can see how much they don't want to be here. You can see that the mere act of existing is depleting for them. And then you have to tell yourself every day, "I am doing the right thing." To let him do what he wants to do is abhorrent to the laws of nature, to the laws of love.
You pounce upon the happy moments. You hold them up as proof. See? This is why it's worth living. This is why I've been making him try. Even though that one moment cannot compensate for all the other moments, the majority of moments. You think, as I had thought with Jacob, what is a child for? Is he to give me comfort? Is he for me to give comfort to? And if a child can no longer be comforted, is it my job to give him permission to leave? And then you think again, but that is abominable. I can't. So I tried, of course. I tried and tried. But every month I could feel him receding. It wasn't so much a physical disappearance. By November he was back at his weight, the low side of it anyway, and looked better than he had perhaps ever. But he was quieter, much quieter. And he had always been quiet anyway. But now he spoke very little. And when we were together, I would sometimes see him looking at something I couldn't see, and then he would twitch his head very slightly, like a horse does its ears, and come back to himself. Once I saw him for our Thursday dinner, and he had bruises on his face and neck, just on one side, as if he was standing near a building in the late afternoon and the sun had cast a shadow against him. The bruises were a dark, rusty brown, like dried blood, and I had gasped. "What happened?" I asked. "I fell," he said shortly. "Don't worry," he said, although of course I did. And when I saw him with bruises again, I tried to hold him. "Tell me," I said, and he worked himself free. "There's nothing to tell," he said. I still don't know what had happened. Had he done something to himself? Had he let someone do something to him? I didn't know which was worse. I didn't know what to do. "He missed you. I missed you too. We all did. I think you should know that. That I didn't just miss you because you made him better. I missed you for you. I missed watching the pleasure you took in doing the things you enjoyed. Whether it was eating or running after a tennis ball or flinging yourself into the pool. I missed talking with you, missed watching you move through a room, missed watching you fall to the lawn under a passel of Lawrence's grandchildren, pretending that you couldn't get up from under their weight. That same day, Lawrence's youngest grandchild, the one who had a crush on you, had made you a bracelet of knotted together dandelion flowers. And you had thanked her and worn it all day. And every time she had spotted it on your wrist, she had run over and buried her face in her father's back. I missed that too. But mostly, I missed watching you two together. I missed watching you watch him, and him watch you. I missed how thoughtful you were with each other. Missed how thoughtlessly, sincerely affectionate you were with him. Missed watching you listen to each other, the way you both did so intently. That painting J.B. did, Willem listening to Jude tell a story, was so true, the expression so right. I knew what was happening in the painting, even before I read its title. And I don't want you to think that there weren't happy moments as well, happy days after you left. There were fewer, of course. They were harder to find. Hard to make, but they existed. After we came home from Italy, I began teaching a seminar at Columbia, one open to both law school students and graduate students from the general population. The course was called The Philosophy of Law, The Law of Philosophy, and I co-taught it with an old friend of mine, and in it we discussed the fairness of law, the moral underpinnings of the legal system, and how they sometimes contradicted our national sense of morality. Draymond 241, after all these years. In the afternoon, I saw friends. Julia took a life drawing class. We volunteered at a non-profit that helped professionals, doctors, lawyers, teachers, from other countries, Sudan, Afghanistan, Nepal, find new jobs in their fields,
even if these jobs bore only a tangential resemblance to what they had done before. Nurses became medical assistants, judges became clerks. A few of them I helped apply to law school, and when I saw them, we would talk about what they were learning, how different this law was from the law they had known. "I think we should work on a project together," I told him that fall. He was still doing pro bono work with the artist nonprofit, which, when I went there to volunteer there myself, was actually more moving than I had thought it would be. I had thought it would just be a bunch of untalented hacks trying to make creative lives for themselves when it was clear they never would. And although that was in fact what it was, I found myself admiring them, much as he did. Their perseverance, their dumb, hardy faith. These were people no one and nothing could ever dissuade from life, from claiming it as theirs. "Like what?" he asked. "You could teach me to cook," I told him, as he gave me that look he had, in which he was almost smiling, but not quite, amused, but not ready to show it. "I'm serious. Really cook. 6 or 7 dishes I could have in my arsenal." And so he did. Saturday afternoons, after he'd finished work or visiting with Lucian and the Irvines, we'd drive to Garrison, either alone or with Richard and India, or J.B., or one of the Henry Youngs and their wives, and on Sunday we'd cook something. My main problem, it emerged, was a lack of patience, my inability to accept tedium. I'd wander away to look for something to read and forget that I was leaving the risotto to glue itself into a sticky glop, or I'd forget to turn the carrots in their puddle of olive oil and come back to find them seared to the bottom of the pan. So much of cooking, it seemed, was petting and bathing and monitoring and flipping and turning and soothing, demands I associated with human infancy. My other problem, I was told, was my insistence on innovating, which is apparently a guarantee of failure in baking. "It's chemistry, Harold, not philosophy," he kept saying, with that same half-smile. "You can't cheat the specified amounts and hope it's going to come out the way it should." "Maybe it'll come out better," I said, mostly to entertain him. I was always happy to play the fool if I thought it might give him some pleasure. And now he smiled, really smiled. "It won't," he said. But finally, I actually did learn how to make some things. I learned how to roast a chicken and poach an egg and broil halibut. I learned how to make a carrot cake and a bread with lots of different nuts that I had liked to buy at the bakery he used to work at in Cambridge. His version was uncanny, and for weeks I made loaf after loaf. "Excellent, Harold," he said one day, after tasting a slice. "See? Now you'll be able to cook for yourself when you're 100. "What do you mean, cook for myself?" I asked him. "You'll have to cook for me." And he smiled back at me, a sad, strange smile, and didn't say anything. And I quickly changed the subject before he said something that I would have to pretend he didn't. I was always trying to allude to the future, to make plans for years away, so that he'd commit to them, and I could make him honor his commitment. But he was careful. He never promised. "We should take a music class, you and I told him, not really knowing what I meant by that. He smiled a little. "Maybe," he said. "Sure, we'll discuss it." But that was the most he'd allow. After our cooking lesson, we walked. When we were at the house upstate, we walked the path Malcolm had made, past the spot in the woods where I had once had to leave him propped against a tree, jolting with pain, past the first bench, past the second, past the third. At the second bench, we'd always sit and rest. He didn't need to rest, not like he used to, and we walked so slowly that I didn't need to either. But we always made a ceremonial stop, because it was from here that you had the clearest view of the back of the house. Do you remember? Malcolm had cut away some of the trees here so that from the bench you were facing the house straight on, and if you were on the back deck of the house, you were facing the bench straight on.
It's such a beautiful house, I said, as I always did. And as I always did, I hoped he was hearing me say that I was proud of him, for the house he built, and for the life he had built within it. Once, a month or so after we all returned home from Italy, we were sitting on this bench, and he said to me, "Do you think he was happy with me?" He was so quiet I thought I had imagined it. But then he looked at me, and I saw I hadn't. "Of course he was," I told him. "I know he was." He shook his head. "There were so many things I didn't do," he said at last. I didn't know what he meant by this, but it didn't change my mind. "Whatever it was, I know it didn't matter," I told him. "I know he was happy with you. He told me." He looked at me then. "I know it," I repeated. "I know it." "You had never said this to me, not explicitly, but I know you will forgive me. I know you will. I know you would have wanted me to say this." "Another time," he said, "Dr. Lohmann thinks I should tell you things." "What things?" I asked, careful not to look at him. "Things about what I am," he said, and then paused. "Who I am," he corrected himself. "Well," I said, finally, "I'd like that. I'd like to know more about you." Then he smiled. "That sounds strange, doesn't it?" he asked. "More about you. We've known each other so long now. I always had the sense during these exchanges that, although there might not be a single correct answer, there was in fact a single incorrect one, after which he would never say anything again. And I was forever trying to calculate what that answer might be, so I would never say it." "That's true," I said. "But I always want to know more, where you're concerned." He looked at me quickly, and then back at the house. "Well," he said, "maybe I'll try. Maybe I'll write something down." "I'd love that," I said. "Whenever you're ready." "It might take me a while," he said. "That's fine," I said. "It'll take as long as you need." A long time was a good thing, I thought. It meant years, years of him trying to figure out what he wanted to say. And although they would be difficult, torturous years, at least he would be alive. That was what I thought, that I would rather have him suffering and alive than dead. But in the end, it didn't take him much time at all. It was February, about a year after our intervention. If he could keep his weight on through May, we'd stop monitoring him, and he'd be able to stop seeing Dr. Lohmann if he wanted, although both Andy and I thought he should keep going. But it would no longer be our decision. That Sunday we had stayed in the city, and after a cooking lesson at Green Street, an asparagus and artichoke tureen, we went out for our walk. It was a chilly day, but windless, and we walked south on Green Street until it changed into Church, and then down and down through Tribeca, through Wall Street, and almost to the very tip of the island, where we stood and watched the river, its splashing gray water. And then we turned and walked north, back up the same street, Trinity to Church, Church to Green. He had been quiet all day, still and silent, and I prattled on about a middle-aged man I had met at the Career Placement Center, a refugee from Tibet, a year or so older than he, a doctor, who was applying to American medical schools. "That's admirable," he said. "It's difficult to start over." "It is," I said. "But you've started over too, Jude. You're admirable too." He glanced at me, then looked away. "I mean it," I said. I was reminded of a day a year or so after he had been discharged from the hospital after his suicide attempt, and he was staying with us in Truro. We had taken a walk then as well. "I want you to tell me three things you think you do better than anyone else," I had told him as we sat on the sand, and he made a weary puffing noise,
filling his cheeks with air and blowing it out through his mouth.
"Not now, Harold," he had said.
"Come on," I said. "Three things. Three things you do better than anyone, and then I'll stop bothering you." But he thought and thought, and still couldn't think of anything. And hearing his silence, something in me began to panic.
"Three things you do well, then," I revised. "Three things you like about yourself."
By this time I was almost begging.
"Anything," I told him.
"Anything." "I'm tall," he finally said. "Tallish, anyway."
"Tall is good," I said,
although I had been hoping for something different, something more qualitative. But I would accept it as an answer, I decided. It had taken him so long to come up with even that.
"Two more."
But he couldn't think of anything else. I could see he was getting frustrated and embarrassed, and finally I let the subject drop. Now, as we moved through Tribeca, he mentioned very casually that he had been asked to be the firm's chairman.
"My God," I said. "That's amazing, Jude. My God. Congratulations."
He nodded once. "But I'm not going to accept it," he said. And I was thunderstruck. After all he had given fucking Rosen Pritchard, all those hours, all those years, he wasn't going to take it? He looked at me.
"I'd have thought you'd be happy," he said.
And I shook my head.
"No,"
I told him. "I know how much satisfaction you get from your job. I don't want you to think that I don't approve of you, that I'm not proud of you." He didn't say anything.
"Why aren't you going to take it?"
I asked him.
"You'd be great at it. You were born for it."
And then he winced. I wasn't sure why, and looked away.
"No,"
he said. "I don't think I would be." It was a controversial decision anyway, as I understand it. "Besides," he began, and then stopped. Somehow we had stopped walking as well, as if speech and movement were oppositional activities, and we stood there in the cold for a while. "Besides," he continued, "I thought I'd leave the firm in a year or so." He looked at me, as if to see how I was reacting, and then looked up at the sky. "I thought maybe I'd travel," he said. But his voice was hollow and joyless, as if he were being conscripted into a faraway life he didn't much want.
"I could go away," he said, almost to himself. "There are places I should see."
I didn't know what to say. I stared and stared at him.
"I could come with you,"
I whispered. And he came back to himself and looked at me.
"Yes," he said.
And he sounded so declarative I felt comforted.
"Yes, you could come with me, or you two could come meet me in certain places."
We started moving again. "Not that I want to unduly delay your second act as a world traveler," I said, "but I do think you should reconsider Rosen Pritchard's offer. Maybe do it for a few years, and then jet off to the Balearics, or Mozambique, or wherever it is you want to go." I knew that if he accepted the chairmanship offer, then he wouldn't kill himself. He was too responsible to leave with unfinished business.
"Okay," I prompted him.
He smiled then, his old, bright, beautiful smile.
"Okay, Harold," he said.
"I promise I'll reconsider." Then we were just a few blocks from home, and I realized we were coming up on Lispinard Street.
"Oh, God," I said, seeking to capitalize on his good mood, to keep us both aloft. "Here we are at the site of all my nightmares, the worst apartment in the world."
And he laughed, and we veered right off of church and walked half a block down Lispinard Street until we were standing in front of your old building. For a while I ranted on and on about the place, about how horrible it was, exaggerating and embroidering for effect, to hear him laugh and protest.
I was always afraid a fire was going to go ripping through that place and you'd both end up dead, I said. I had dreams of getting phoned by the emergency technicians that they'd found you both gnawed to death by a swarm of rats. It wasn't that bad, Harold. He smiled. I have very fond memories of this place, actually. And then the mood turned again, and we both stood there staring at the building and thinking of you and him and all the years between this moment and the one in which I had met him. So young. So terribly young. And at that time, just another student. Terrifically smart and intellectually nimble. But nothing more. Not the person I could have ever imagined him becoming for me. And then he said he was trying to make me feel better, too. We were each performing for the other. Did I ever tell you about the time we jumped off the roof to the fire escape outside our bedroom? What? I asked. Genuinely appalled. No, you never did. I think I would have remembered that. But although I could never have imagined the person he would become for me, I knew how he would leave me. Despite all my hopes and pleas and insinuations and threats and magical thoughts, I knew. And 5 months later, June 12th, a day with no significant anniversaries associated with it, a nothing day. He did. My phone rang, and although it wasn't a sinister time of night, and although nothing had happened that I would later see as foreshadowing, I knew. I knew. And on the other end was J.B., and he was breathing oddly, in rapid bursts. And even before he spoke, I knew. He was 53. 53 for not even 2 months. He had injected an artery with air and had given himself a stroke. And although Andy had told me his death would have been quick and painless, I later looked it up online and found he had lied to me. It would have meant sticking himself at least twice with a needle whose gauge was as thick as a hummingbird's beak. It would have been agonizing. When I went to his apartment, finally, it was so neat, with his office boxed up, and the refrigerator emptied, and everything, his will, letters, tiered on the dining room table, like place cards at a wedding. Richard, J.B., Andy, all of your and his old friends. They were all around constantly, all of us moving about and around one another, shocked but not shocked. Surprised only that we were so surprised, devastated and beaten and mostly helpless. Had we missed something? Could we have done something different? After his service, which was crowded, with his friends and your friends and their parents and families, with his law school classmates, with his clients, with the staff and patrons of the arts nonprofit, with the board of the food kitchen, with a huge population of Rosen Pritchard employees past and present, including Meredith, who came with an almost completely discombobulated Lucian, who lives cruelly to this day, although in a nursing home in Connecticut, with our friends, with people I wouldn't have expected, Kit and Emil and Philippa and Robin, Andy came to me, crying, and confessed that he thought things had started really going wrong for him after he told him he was leaving his practice, and that it was his fault. I hadn't even known Andy was leaving. He had never mentioned it to me, but I comforted him and told him it wasn't his fault, not at all, that he had always been good to him, that I had always trusted him. At least Willem isn't here, we said to one another. At least Willem isn't here to see this. Though, of course, if you were here, wouldn't he still be as well? But if I cannot say that I didn't know how he would die, I can say that there was much I didn't know. Not at all. Not after all. I didn't know that Andy would be dead 3 years later of a heart attack, or Richard 2 years after that of brain cancer.
You all died so young. You, Malcolm, him, Elijah, of a stroke when he was 60. Citizen, when he was 60 as well, of pneumonia. In the end, there was, and is, only J.B., to whom he left the house in Garrison, and whom we see often, there or in the city, or in Cambridge. J.B. has a serious boyfriend now, a very good man named Tomash, a specialist in Japanese medieval art at Sotheby's, whom we like very much. I know both you and he would have as well. And although I feel bad for myself, for us, of course, I feel most bad most often for J.B., deprived of you all, left to live the beginnings of old age by himself, with new friends, certainly, but without most of his friends who had known him since he was a child. At least I have known him since he was 22, off and on, perhaps, but neither of us count the off years. And now J.B. is 61, and I am 84, and he has been dead for 6 years, and you have been dead for 9. J.B.'s most recent show was called Jude Alone, and was of 15 paintings of just him, depicting imagined moments from the years after you died, from those nearly 3 years he managed to hang on without you. I have tried, but I cannot look at them. I try and try, but I cannot. And there were still more things I didn't know. He was right. We had only moved to New York for him. And after we had settled his estate, Richard was his executor, though I helped him. We went home to Cambridge, to be near the people who had known us for so long. I'd had enough of cleaning and sorting. We had, along with Richard and J.B. and Andy, gone through all of his personal papers, there weren't many, and clothes, a heartbreak itself, watching his suits get narrower and narrower, and your clothes. We had looked through your files at Lantern House together, which took many days because we kept stopping to cry or exclaim or pass around a picture none of us had seen before. But when we were back home, back in Cambridge, the very movement of organizing had become reflexive, and I sat down one Saturday to clean out the bookcases, an ambitious project that I soon lost interest in, when I found, tucked between two books, two envelopes, our names in his handwriting. I opened my envelope, my heart thrumming, and saw my name, Dear Harold, and read his note from decades ago, from the day of his adoption, and cried, sobbed, really. And then I slipped the disk into the computer and heard his voice. And although I would have cried anyway for its beauty, I cried more because it was his. And then Julia came home and found me and read her note, and we cried all over again. And it wasn't until a few weeks after that I was able to open the letter he had left us on his table. I hadn't been able to bear it earlier. I wasn't sure I would be able to bear it now, but I did. It was 8 pages long, and typed, and it was a confession of Brother Luke and Dr. Traylor and what had happened to him. It took us several days to read, because although it was brief, it was also endless, and we had to keep putting the pages down and walking away from them, and then bracing each other. Ready? And sitting down and reading some more. I'm sorry, he wrote. Please forgive me. I never meant to deceive you. I still don't know what to say about that letter. I still cannot think of it. All those answers I had wanted about who and why he was, and now those answers only torment. That he died so alone is more than I can think of. That he died thinking that he owed us an apology is worse. That he died still stubbornly believing everything he was taught about himself. After you, after me, after all of us who loved him. Makes me think that my life has been a failure after all, that I have failed at the one thing that counted. It is then that I talk to you the most, that I go downstairs late at night and stand before Willem listening to Jude tell a story, which now hangs above our dining room table. Willem, I ask you, do you feel like I do? Do you think he was happy with me? Because he deserved happiness. We aren't guaranteed it. None of us are. But he deserved it. But you only smile. Not at me, but just past me. And you never have an answer. It is also then that I wish I believed in some sort of life after life. That in another universe, maybe on a small red planet where we have not legs but tails, where we paddle through the atmosphere like seals, where the air itself is sustenance, composed of trillions of molecules of protein and sugar, and all one has to do is open one's mouth and inhale in order to remain alive and healthy. Maybe you two are together, floating through the climate. Or maybe he is closer still. Maybe he is that gray cat that has begun to sit outside our neighbor's house, purring when I reach out my hand to it. Maybe he is that new puppy I see tugging at the end of my other neighbor's leash. Maybe he is that toddler I saw running through the square a few months ago, shrieking with joy, his parents huffing after him. Maybe he is that flower that suddenly bloomed on the rhododendron bush I thought had died long ago. Maybe he is that cloud, that wave, that rain, that mist. It isn't only that he died, or how he died. It is what he died believing. And so I try to be kind to everything I see. And in everything I see him. But back then, back on Lispinard Street, I didn't know so much of this. Then, we were only standing and looking up at that red brick building, and I was pretending that I never had to fear for him, that he was letting me pretend this, that all the dangerous things he could have done, all the ways he could have broken my heart, were in the past, the stuff of stories, that the time that lay behind us was scary, but the time that lay ahead of us was not. You jumped off the roof? I repeated. Why on earth would you have done such a thing? It's a good story, he said. He even grinned at me. I'll tell you. Please, I said. And then he did.
This has been an Audible Studios production of A Little Life, a novel. Written by Hanya Yanagihara. Performed by Oliver Wyman. Producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 2015 by Hanya Yanagihara. Production copyright 2015 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.